This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Commemorating the 10th anniversary of the greatest comic book movie of all time, the Hard Driving Fanboys celebrate Dark Knight Month.
Welcome, everyone, to the L-Shaped Studio, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, Hoholoon Plaza. We are the hard-traveling boys. I am the never-flustered, always well-connected Greg Phillips. With me, as always, my partner, Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
I'm doing well, and I would like everyone to know that that Greg...
...into the show, and a podcast host extraordinaire of his own. One Russell Sellers. Welcome, Russell Sellers.
I was wondering when you would introduce me.
My God, Bane has joined the show. Ladies and gentlemen, what a shocking run-in.
Oh, the fire rises, my friend. I have come like fire.
Well, if there's one thing that we're known for doing... here at the show, it's coming like fire, so we are glad to have you aboard to talk about the third entry in Christopher Nolan's historic Batman trilogy. That's right, folks. Dark Knight Month continues at the Hard Traveling Fanboys with our last off the page of the month, an examination of The Dark Knight Rises. Now, Russell... thank you so much again for joining us for this little journey to the conclusion of this historic franchise.
Yes, it is a powerful movie, especially for you and I, Greg, considering where our Batman fandom tends to lead us. And it gives us both something that we never thought we'd see on screen. And even though I consider this the second best movie in the Dark Knight trilogy, there's still a big moment in this one that I think you and I were pretty much coming up out of our seats when it happens.
100%. And I can't wait to talk about it. I don't think we're going to get through the entire movie tonight, but what we're going to do is we're going to try to talk about the totality of the movie.
Yes.
So we will get there for sure. Nick, how do you feel this week? How are you doing? And what does it mean to you to reach this point in our journey on the Dark Knight month?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I'm obviously looking forward to digging back in here. I know a lot of people after last week are probably looking forward to something that is a bit more of a critical and balanced discussion of a Chris Nolan film. And I hate to inform those people, you're not going to get that on this podcast.
No.
I have made no secret of the esteem I hold this trilogy in, and I got news for you. That's going to continue on into this episode. Now, granted, as we'll discuss, I can't honestly put it on the level of the movie we discussed last week because I do think The Dark Knight is the greatest movie of all time, but this comes damn close for me, so I'm looking forward to looking back at it.
What would Chris Berman say about this movie?
It's pretty good.
Very good. Very good. Now, before all that rigmarole, we get going in all this, we'll just explain to you a little bit of how this works. If for some reason you've missed the rest of our Dark Knight Month podcast, what we do with Off the Page is we grab a copy of the movie, we put it on 000 to the very beginning of the movie, and we like to give you, the audience, if you so choose, an opportunity to watch it along with us. Get your copy of the movie. Find it, you know, if you have it somewhere digitally, physically, whatever, go ahead and load that up, pause it at the beginning, and you can follow us along. We're not going to watch the entire movie, but we're going to use it to guide us in our conversations, remind us of some things that we might have thought about or might not have thought about otherwise. And in full disclosure, I'm actually not able to follow along this week due to connection issues. So a lot of it may be Nick and Russell seeing things that remind them of conversation topics. And I've seen the movie very recently, so I remember virtually the entire thing. So we're going to go from there, and we're going to let you go ahead and get your copy of it. And then we're going to start this thing going in 3, 2, 1, play. So, obviously, there had been 4 years since the release of The Dark Knight.
Yes.
When we got The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, good call on that one, Greg.
So, you know, a lot of time for anticipation, a lot of time for expectations to get created for this movie, because it's coming on the heels of what we all consider to be the greatest comic book movie of them all. And here we are, 2012, the trailers are coming out, the anticipation is building for this movie. What is going through the respective minds of our panel here today?
It wasn't quite to the hype level that Dark Knight was, just because, you know, viral marketing played a role in Dark Knight Rises, but they kind of scaled back on it a bit coming into this. It wasn't quite the in-depth interactive experience that you had with The Dark Knight. And to be honest, it just was one of those things where, for me personally, you know, The Dark Knight was a movie that was going to introduce Harvey Dent. It was a movie that was going to have the Joker. It was a movie that was going to do all these things that it's difficult to get me that excited all over again. But I will say it came close enough just because of how much I love The Dark Knight. So, wow. Sorry, I just got blown away by the fact that I'm watching the screen and it did that convert to full screen effect that we talked about last week because of the IMAX transfer that I'm watching on my glorious 4K. And there's that dude that plays fucking Littlefinger. Fuck that guy. I'm looking forward to him getting brutally murdered here in a minute. But, yeah, so the hype level, very, very high. Not quite to the level of Dark Knight, but I think part of that is because 2012 was a year where our hype kind of had to be spread, whereas in 2008, yes, you had Iron Man that kind of came out of nowhere, but all the hype in 2008 was driven in one specific direction. 2012, you can make a strong argument that Dark Knight Rises might have been overshadowed a little bit that summer.
Yeah, you had Avengers drop that year, so it was, and you had Avengers drop before Dark Knight Rises came out, so that was that was certainly a you know, I hate to say it, but I think that Avengers definitely would have overshadowed this just because of the of what it represented.
Yeah, it was the first of its kind. Like, it was truly history making.
Yes.
So
that, but here in Dark Knight Rises, especially this scene that we're seeing right now, I actually think this is a really killer opening.
Yes,
maybe not quite, you know, Joker intro from Dark Knight, but this is still really damn good introduction to Bane. I especially love this part where he's holding this dude out of a plane, like he's going to drop him or something, but he is holding a gun to his head, and I love how Bane points out to him, what kind of a person would shoot someone before throwing them out of a plane?
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant, yeah.
Just a great performance here from Tom Hardy, and I, for one, never had any trouble understanding what he was saying. I had more trouble understanding Michael Caine on the boat from The Dark Knight than I ever had understanding Bane. I thought that people made much ado about nothing over the mask.
I will say that in the final released version, I will agree with you. However, I actually got to see this prologue in IMAX when they released it at the Huntsville Space and Rocket Center. And in that little 5-minute preview that they did on the IMAX screen, I will say there, before they remixed the audio, it wasn't unintelligible, but you definitely had to – you found yourself kind of doing that lean forward thing, trying to make out what he was saying. But by the time they remixed it, I've never had an issue understanding him in the subsequent audio mixes.
No, not at all. No, me either. And I'll just say my hype for this one going in was extreme. Like, probably – it's weird to say because the Avengers did represent so much more, but because I have much more of an emotional connection, I guess, to the DC Universe, Dark Knight Rises was a bigger deal to me because it was following up my favorite superhero movie. And it was introducing a version of Bane. And you guys know this, but I really don't talk about him a lot on our podcast. But Bane is actually one of my favorite Batman villains and has been since I was a kid. I also think he's been one of the most horribly utilized Batman villains. Just see Batman Forever, or Batman and Robin, I should say. Virtually every comic book he appeared in, until Gail Simone got him in Suicide Squad, post Nightfall, I mean. So, I mean, I think Bane's a character that has certainly gone through his
You mean Secret Six, right?
Secret Six, yeah. That's exactly right, yeah. So Bane's a character that's gone through peaks and valleys over his tenure as a character, and I was really excited to see what someone of Nolan's abilities could do with Bane and how he would wrap up a story that was in such an interesting spot at the end of The Dark Knight. And yeah, this opening is phenomenal. I absolutely love it. And it again represents Nolan's continuing evolution as a filmmaker, because this is, you know, he had done Inception in between The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises. Mm-hmm. And Inception is the movie where he really just seemed to, I guess, click with how to create a classic all-time action sequence where there were just unforgettable, mind-blowing visual aesthetic experience for an action scene. Mm-hmm. And he does that here right in this opening. And it's the first of what I think will be several standout action scenes throughout this movie where you see Nolan's evolution in that level as he is finally figuring out a little bit of fight choreography, things like that, ways to organize scenes to make them work, and putting that into the context of his already brilliant filmmaking. So
that, by the way, right there,
I'm a huge fan of this opener.
What we just saw with the plane dropping and the shot from overhead, once again, a practical shot. Literally went into the middle of nowhere. His prop team constructed half a fuselage. They had a giant plane overhead they used to rig a camera to, had two stunt guys hanging on the rope and literally shot that fuselage dropping to the ground. They had one take at it and nailed it in one take, much like the hospital explosion in The Dark Knight.
And Tom Hardy's performance during, spot on, loved it. Loved that they work in so many little intricate details within that scene too. Like, they wanted to kidnap this one doctor, but they wanted to make sure that everyone else who might become looking for him would think that he was dead. So they perform a blood transfusion on a dead body in mid-flight because they know that when that fuselage crashes, whatever's left in there is going to be unrecognizable or unidentifiable except through maybe DNA.
Some DNA, yeah.
Yeah, so, and that person would be found to be the doctor who was supposedly kidnapped, along with one of Bane's own men who sacrifices himself so that one person can be found in the wreckage. Mm-hmm. So it is a pretty crazy opening scene, and one that doesn't that takes a little while to pay off. We actually don't know what happens there until much later in the movie.
It's one of many things in especially Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises that, you know, they are plot elements that you just kind of have to put together on your own. It's never directly explained that, hey, he used the dead guy, you know, to pump blood into so that you would get a false DNA reading. You just kind of have to put that together. Much like the, I know one of the things that people pick apart about The Dark Knight is the Harvey Dent victims that Gordon brings up at the end of the movie, even though if you sit there and really think about it, you can get to that number. Nolan is a guy who is not going to spell out everything for the audience. He expects a certain level of attention and focus from his audience that most directors in general don't do, and certainly directors of big-budget blockbuster comic book movies these days would never be able to get away with doing, even if they wanted to.
Yeah, and this scene we're seeing right now with Gordon speaking at the newly fully rebuilt Wayne Manor on the what seems to be, I guess it's the 8th anniversary of Harvey Dent's death, and the success of the Dent Act locking up 1,000 criminals in Blackgate. While you can kind of feel like his sadness in that, talking about Harvey. I think what he's really doing there is laying out the heavy stakes of this movie right up front, that if people found out that Harvey was actually this, you know, pretty awful person by the end of the last movie, that it would undo everything, and that's the number of inmates who'd probably be immediately released. So that's, I really kind of appreciate this scene in hindsight a little bit more than I did when I initially watched it.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's setting the stage for the stakes of the movie, and I think laying out the ultimate moral quandary of this film and the ultimate, I've talked a lot in the past and will on the show about how Dark Knight Rises is really taking the themes from Batman Begins and following them through. This is the element from The Dark Knight that's bringing full circle the ramifications of that decision at the end.
Yes, Robo Greg is certainly in full effect right now. And as we all know about Robo Greg, tastes like baby food.
All the things that Harvey had done.
He is just rolling right along. Man. Yep.
Robo Greg cannot hear us.
You're a wise man, Greg.
Coming to Dark Knight. And you see here that.
My God.
No, I can hear everything you guys.
It's.
Well, folks, yeah. It's going to be an interesting one tonight. Buckle up your seatbelts and we'll get through it somehow. But Greg was making a point that I am sure was very eloquent and well-spoken, and a point that you will never actually hear said. So,
I think it comes down to this. This movie feels the most like Batman Begins of the entire trilogy, other than, you know, Batman Begins itself. Like it's the one that feels like it thematically goes back to that. Like any good trilogy, the third film ties back more closely to the beginning. Mm-hmm. And The Dark Knight Rises is, you know, to me, and I think to what Greg was saying, less a sequel to The Dark Knight, but more a sequel to Batman Begins.
And that's true, but I think you can't talk about this movie without addressing the elephant in the room, which is the what if. Because I truly believe that had Heath Ledger not passed away, we would have gotten something that was a sequel to both. That was thematically more heavily tied into The Dark Knight than they were able to do because of the death of Heath Ledger. By the way, one thing we should just go ahead and talk about up front, you know, because when we talk about these movies, we typically run through the casting. Not as controversial as the Heath Ledger casting in The Dark Knight by any means, but there were definitely a lot of Anne Hathaway skeptics coming into this film. I did not count myself among them. I thought she was going to be really good. But that moment when she goes, nobody told me it was uncrackable, that was the moment I was like, yep, I was right. And like, she totally, and from then on, she's full on Selena and never really drops out of it again throughout the rest of the movie.
Not at all. Like that opening scene, like the first time you see her on screen, she's very like meek and meager. It doesn't really, I mean, she's, you know, really playing that whole, you know, damsel thing, playing it really well. And then, like you said, as soon as she flips that switch to being Catwoman to being Selena, it's spot on. It is absolutely the best Catwoman performance on screen ever.
Agreed. Yes, completely.
Hey, Greg's back.
Hey, Robo Greg is here.
For the time being, I am here. I've gone through a horrific accident in which I was gunned down brutally, as you know.
Now let me ask you this: what are your feelings on Sting, and will you be accompanying him to the ring anytime soon?
I'm not going to accompany him to the ring, but if he gets locked into a shark cage at some point, you rest assured that I'll be there to come out and rip that door off its hinges.
Okay,
and then stand there awkwardly.
Okay.
Now we're up to another part that may have come with a bit of controversy in the casting, because I remember when it was announced that Joseph Gordon-Levitt was joining the cast of The Dark Knight Rises, and of course my JGL fanboy heart just, you know, leapt up into my throat, and it never really came back down. And there were rumors galore about who he would be playing. Everyone from the Riddler to
everyone in the Nolan versus the Riddler. Yes, like that's just that's just a fact.
That was thrown out there. He was referred to as possibly the Holiday Killer from Dark Victory, Long Halloween. Mm-hmm. He was rumored to be the son of Moroni. You know, that was a big thing for a while, and then everyone started gearing towards, oh, well, wait a minute, could he be playing Dick Grayson? And then it was revealed that he was playing this this new character, this never before seen character in the Batman universe, John Blake. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was kind of threw some people off. It was a little disappointing, but as this movie would progress, we started to see that John Blake was in fact an amalgamation of the three main Robins from Batman's history, that being Dick Grayson, Jason Todd, and Tim Drake.
Yep, 100%.
As he has elements of all three. And as we'll get to a little bit later, just that that moment when in his quote, real name is revealed, some people felt that was a little on the nose. All it did was send a chill up my spine.
Yeah. So, yeah, to piggyback on what you guys have said, I don't know how long that I'm going to sound normal, even if I do now. Mm-hmm. You guys sound normal to me, so I'm going to assume I sound normal.
Okay.
Do I?
Yes.
Yes. Go.
Okay. Well, while I do, I will just piggyback on what you guys said about Anne Hathaway. I was a skeptic, and I was 100% wrong because – I agree with Russell. She's the best Catwoman there's ever been on screen, television or movie. And she, to me anyway, she encapsulates my version of Catwoman that I grew up with, that I identify with, that I love, that is my favorite female super, well, I don't know if you want to call her a superhero, but an anti-hero slash villainess. And I think that she encapsulates in that opening scene with her in it, everything that I love about Selina, conflicted that she's doing this bad thing, but she can put on an air for somebody else to make them think that she's what she wants them to think. And then as you see during the course of the movie, she's both confident and scared. She's incredibly powerful, and yet she's also deep down vulnerable. And I think it takes a lot to convey that and to convey it with subtlety, and I was really impressed with Anne Hathaway's performance throughout this movie, rounding into the Selina Kyle. Goes back and forth, makes bad decisions along the way, but at the end of the day, makes the right decision.
Absolutely, and not to cut you off, Greg, but here we are at this moment getting the classic Nolan ending set up. It almost feels very much like Inception here, as he is showing you the ending before the ending, and I'm sitting here going, yep. Like, as it happens right now, I'm going, this is probably going to play a role in the ending, and I'm anticipating a very ambiguous ending. I'm already thinking that we're getting Inception ending done again, but in the Batman universe with, you know, with Michael Caine looking up and us not knowing as the audience whether he's seeing Bruce Wayne or not. And by the, when they get there at the end and they actually go through with it, I remember being blown away by the balls to actually
the balls. Do that. Yep.
Isn't it interesting also in this scene that we know that Bruce Wayne has not been Batman for 8 years? That since the end of The Dark Knight, before Wayne Manor was completely rebuilt, he had chosen not to be Batman. Mm-hmm. But he has a Batcave. He has a fully functioning, like kept up Batcave under Wayne Manor. So to Alfred's point that he just made a second ago, he might have hung up the cape and cowl, but the I feel like Nolan used the Batcave itself as a visual and physical representation of Bruce Wayne's own inability to move on. Mm-hmm. So that's,
yeah, he can't let go. He's still obsessed.
Yeah,
he's
like,
just not acting on it.
He lives in that house. He's a recluse. He not just in the house, but he's like a recluse down in that cave. I'm betting that he spent like pretty much every day since he hung it up down in that cave, just obsessing over this idea that he should still be Batman, or that there was, you know, because of the death of Rachel Dawes, that there was, as he said, there was nothing out there for him. But Alfred is pointing out that, you know, you didn't even try to live life. You just shut yourself off from the world as soon as all that ended. And
yeah,
of course, Alfred is still carrying around the secret that Rachel had chosen Harvey over Bruce. And
Bruce is also still racked with guilt, I'm assuming, based on what we see in this movie, from everything that happened to Harvey, everything that happened to Rachel. As we know about Batman and any iteration of the character, he's a character that has a hard time forgiving himself before anyone else. And so I think you're seeing the physical and mental toll that's taken on him in the beginning stages of this movie.
And here we have this great scene with Selina having kidnapped a high-ranking official and kept him pretty well drunk and drugged. Also that she can have a little leverage over this mob boss here who is about to double-cross her. As it turns out, she stole it wasn't stuff from the safe that she was stealing. She was stealing Bruce Wayne's fingerprints. So, yeah, this is a pretty intense scene. I remember seeing this as I was watching this in theaters that, you know, it's just Selina, her drunk captive, and now her friend. I believe this is Holly.
Yeah, it's Holly, Holly Robinson, yes.
Yep, they've introduced here. And the whole thing just feels really tense because it's like they're all well-armed. I mean, this dude did not
present Selina as being this helpless damsel or this, aw-shucks villainess who is all physicality and no brain. She's very, very smart.
And look at Anne Hathaway kicking ass. Like, doing every bit of this stunt work herself. But watch this switch get flipped real fast. Like, she's going to take out all these dudes on her own. That's badass. And as soon as the cops come in, she throws the gun down and goes into, like, a screaming fit of terror.
Mm-hmm. So suddenly she's the victim, right?
Yeah, suddenly she's, like, freaked out. The cops don't know who she is. And they just, like, this whole SWAT team just runs right by her, chasing the dudes with guns. And she's like, well, now that they're gone, see you guys. I got what I wanted. Bye. such a killer scene. And she keeps playing the cops. Like, every time one comes by, she just acts like damsel in distress, including John Blake just now. She, like, completely fooled him.
This is another movie that, like The Dark Knight, we talked about in the last podcast, the trailers for The Dark Knight mm-hmm. were brilliant in how much they excited us without giving away the movie. And it was kind of the same thing here. And nobody really knew what the story was 100% going to be in this movie. We had ideas, we had theories, but nobody really knew. What did you guys make of the time jump? Going 8 years into the future after the end of The Dark Knight. Did that surprise you at all? Or to you, was that the logical place to go after the way we left the last movie?
You know, it kind of felt like it might have been the logical place to go. Because with the end of The Dark Knight, it was either you pick up right after this movie ends and we just flow right along like it's all just one long movie. But I kind of got the feeling, watching Batman Begins and then watching The Dark Knight, that Nolan was doing not just his own take on year one and that level of thinking. I got the feeling that he was going for his own version of The Dark Knight Returns. And for me, it was like seeing how this movie is structured, it does feel a good bit like Dark Knight Returns mixed with Nightfall, which is a pretty brilliant thing to do, and it plays also into the theme of legacy, which is something that, you know, he was looking so desperately for, pretty much from the jump. So going into the future, having him be an older Batman, someone who's kind of broken down a bit, somebody who probably does need to physically hang it up because he probably can't keep doing this. We needed to see that. And if we had picked up immediately after, it would have just left us in the same place of, nah, he's going to be searching forever. He's not going to find somebody like right off. He needed to be in a slightly more desperate situation, and adding in a few years of age and some of those long-standing injuries catching up to him, added a really interesting element to the story for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I think I knew there was going to be a time jump because there was, you know, a pretty I think like 2-3 years or whatever it's implied to be in between Batman Begins and Dark Knight. So I was definitely expecting some sort of time jump. I don't know that I was expecting 8 years. Like, I think that was the part that kind of took me by surprise. And that a thing that they didn't really reveal in marketing up until relatively close to the release of the movie. I think it started to come out in some of the set visits and stuff like that, but it was not mentioned as being part of the story, you know, early on in production. So that did kind of take me by surprise, but looking back on it now, you know, as Russell, you know, so explained so well, makes a lot of sense. Gives Nolan the ability to kind of do his take on Dark Knight Returns, and is able to set up, you know, Bane as an even more physically imposing threat to Batman, because not only is he, you know, legitimately the biggest physical threat Batman's ever faced, but Batman is not at his best. Bruce is, you know, mentally shot just about. He's emotionally drained, and he is
physically
just beaten all the hell due to a condition we call Terry Funkney, actually.
Give it to me straight, Doc, which Bruce pretty much does as a doctor.
Yes.
Bruce, you have no knees.
Your knees don't exist. You see where these should be? This is pudding, just Jell-O pudding.
Although I got to say, that knee brace that Bruce gets here in just in a little bit, what I wouldn't give for one. Being someone who has a bum knee, it would be really cool to, you know, put on this this knee brace that allows me to kick through a brick wall without feeling it.
Yes. Well, and I was going to say, the other thing about this time jump that it does, and the physical ailments that we've been just talking about, right down to the knees, is to use a wrestling comparison, it protects the babyface who's going to lose the big match, right?
Right.
You're not getting prime Batman getting just cleanly beaten in the middle of the ring by Bane. You're getting a worn down, older, a frustrated old man Batman getting beaten down by Bane in his prime. So, you know, it gives you an out that keeps the baby face strong and builds up the heel to this level that, quite frankly, Bane should always be presented at. And it really does it in a very compelling fashion. And so the time jump also leaves you to believe, easier to believe the end of the movie as well, because of all that Batman has gone through, all that Bruce has gone through. He's gone through that personal tragedy through dealing with all that guilt. And as we'll see at the end of the movie, he finally gets to a place where he can move past it.
And speaking of just things that he's moving into and moving past, I like this, this first scene he has with John Blake, where we get Blake's past.
Oh, yes. Here we get the Tim Drake of it all.
Yeah, it's very Tim Drake-esque, but it's also very Jason Todd. Growing up with a good for nothing like gambling father who was always getting himself in trouble, winding up in a boy's home himself. That all just like really screams of Jason Todd.
Jason, yep. And then the fact that he figures out Batman's identity on his own with no help. Is the Tim Drake aspect of it.
Yes, it shows that John Blake is, in fact, a hell of a detective and was from an early age, because he was pretty much knew from the jump, from the first time he sees Bruce Wayne in person, that's Batman. It all just, you know, occurs to him, like he is just that attuned. And, you know, while physically he may not be Batman's equal, I would say that he shows all the makings of being intellectually on Batman's level. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's one thing that we should probably explain here, because John Blake is a character that gets a lot of criticism. I read from online from the people that aren't fans of this movie. A lot of people critique John Blake. Why didn't you just make him Dick Grayson? Something like that. And sure, I would have loved to have seen him be Dick Grayson, but what they're doing is they're creating a character that I don't think a lot of people have realized is an amalgamation, as we mm-hmm. mentioned earlier, of the three main Robins. Jason Todd's orphanage upbringing, well, Tim Drake's detective aspect.
And if you call
Grayson, who is a cop in the late 90s in the Chuck Dixon run.
And if you call him any of those three characters, like directly name him that, then it telegraphs, you know, where you're going. So you kind of have to obscure the path a little bit. You don't want to lay out everything and have everyone know exactly where you're going before you get there. I mean, it would be very easy to do that. That's what most movies do now. But, like, no one wanted to keep something, you know, close to the chest a little bit. So that doesn't that doesn't bug me at all. I think the John Blake criticisms are silly, especially when they come from comics fans who are upset that he isn't Dick Grayson or Tim Drake or Jason Todd. Because if you're proclaiming to be a fan, have enough, like, knowledge of the product to know that he's an amalgamation and he's borrowing elements from all three of these characters, because no one knows. He's only getting one shot at this. And so he's going to give, you know, his best interpretation of Robin, and he does so by paying homage to each of the three main incarnations of that character over the character's history.
Nolan is done with Batman at this point. This is his planned ending to his series. He knows he's not going to do Robin movies. So what he's doing is he's taking his one shot, and he's giving us a character. And I can tell you, and I think Russell feels the same way about this, Dick Grayson's my favorite comic book character, and so the fact that I am this high on this movie is because I've read Dick Grayson comics since I was a kid, and because I understand his history, and I recognize in John Blake, he may not be called Dick Grayson, but he encompasses all of the characteristics that I love about Dick Grayson that make him my favorite comic book character.
And that, yeah, I'm right there with you, because this is the attitude that John Blake has is very Dick Grayson. The way he approaches things, his sense of justice, and how he reacts to things comes off as Dick Grayson to me. But to bring up where we were in the movie just now, Bruce Wayne decided to go and get his knee checked out by a doctor, but it was all to give him an excuse or give him a way to check on Jim Gordon, who had been shot in the sewer by Bane's men. And that scene
this is
where
another touching scene here.
Yeah, that scene when he jumps out of the window and sees or goes to see Commissioner Gordon up close. Gordon has got to be willfully ignoring some things here, because he is way too good a detective not to pick out exactly what kind of suit this guy is wearing and to deduce that this guy comes from money.
Well, I'm also assuming that Gordon's under pretty heavy sedation and under the influence of many different painkillers at this point. So it's not like Gordon has the clearest of heads.
And he dropped acid before he got shot. So.
And how awesome was that moment where Bruce Wayne, being seen in public for the first time in forever, all the paparazzi turned to take a picture of him, and he emits a localized EMP to shut their cameras off. I thought that was a pretty nifty little fight that Lucius cooked up for
him. Yes, 100. Yeah, totally agree. And this is setting up. I mean, I've got so many favorite scenes in this movie, but this is one of many of my favorite scenes in the movie. I adore this. And I've come to realize through this rewatch, guys, that something that I don't think I fully appreciated until now, just how much I love every single public Bruce Wayne scene in all three of these movies. You don't get them a lot, but the ones that are here are amazing.
I think it's because we all have such affinities for Batman the Animated Series, and this feels very inspired by the public Bruce Wayne from that series. It's kind of taken to a whole other level, because you get to really step up the Playboy aspect of it in these, but it's definitely more akin to that and what we know from the comics than the Burton take was, because the Burton take was like weird, eccentric loner guy that felt like he was straight out of a Tim Burton movie, quite frankly. So, you know, this just feels more familiar, and as a result, I think we wind up liking it all better. But as you alluded to, Greg, I think the reason you were talking about the scene hitting so big for you is we're going to get this very, you know, foreshadowing, having, you know, conversation between Bruce and Selina, and the acting ability of both these actors to nail this material is just remarkable, and it shows you for the first time the chemistry that these two are going to have throughout the movie. And without that chemistry, the ending, in my opinion, doesn't work. But because of this chemistry, it lands at the end.
Absolutely does. And I love that she has cat ears on her costume, on her little masquerade costume here. That's and that he refers to her as a cat burglar is a little, it's my kind of on the nose. It's the kind of thing that I will pop for.
It's throwing us a freaking bone here.
And as much as I love the chemistry between Anne Hathaway and Christian Bale, I gotta say the chemistry between Bale and Marion Cotillard just a minute ago was pretty great too. I totally buy into that that relationship just almost as much as I buy into Bruce and Selena.
Well, you know, it plays off of what I was talking about a minute ago. These Bruce Wayne scenes in these three movies are so good, and I don't think I really fully appreciated them until viewing them in context of the trilogy in the last 3 weeks. But Bale does such a good job of both putting on that public persona while only through his eyes, and there's a lot of that in this movie, acting through eyes, as we'll talk about with Tom Hardy in a bit. Only through his eyes you can tell that it's a charade, that it's almost, it almost eats him up to do this kind of stuff, because this is not the real him. And only in this conversation with Selena while they're dancing do you get that, because she is so caustic. Every single line that she delivers bites. It's like everything burns. And it's almost like you can feel her loathing for people like Bruce Wayne. And then his responses back to her kind of give away that he's not like everyone else that she thinks that he is. He's different. And it's just such a great, you know, repartee between them, back and forth exchange here. And just one of my favorite scenes in the movie, because it captures the elements here. And then
speaking of great scenes,
takes the necklace back.
I guess I'm a little ahead of you guys, but speaking of great moments, he got the necklace back, but he goes to get his car, and the valet says, your wife took it. And he's like, my wife? And then we cut to Selena speeding away in his Lamborghini. And then as he gets into the back of Alfred's car, as Alfred has come to pick him up, he's just like, you know, don't worry about it, Master Wayne. Takes a little bit to get back in the swing of things. Oh, man.
This is another bit. For a movie series that is joyless, I sure do laugh a lot when I'm watching these movies.
Yeah.
You can't help it. It's so good. The humor is just subtle and nuanced. But if you're paying attention to the movie, you don't need the slapstick beat you about the head and neck area with our jokes and humor. It's all there, and you'll catch it. You know, just as Nolan tends to do with all of his movies, all he's really asking is that the audience pay attention to it. And really, how is that hard to do with such a finely written, directed, and just acted film?
Morgan Freeman is back here as Lucius Fox, and also adding to that, Russell, that sense of wit and that sense of humor. He has great one-liners throughout the movie, and he also again grounds the movie in a little bit of that moral compass role, you know.
Yes,
and
Lucius Fox is the conscience of this movie, of this entire trilogy. He is the, as you very eloquently put it, he is the moral compass that guides this movie forward. He is a bit of an enabler Bruce Wayne. Yeah, he's a bit of an enabler to Bruce Wayne. No more so than I think Alfred is.
I will disagree with that. This movie definitely takes the different tact on that, because Alfred pretty much is like, I'm not going to enable you anymore. And Lucius kind of just is like, I'm just going to power on, keep on going.
Hey, but tit for tat, because Lucius was the one in the last movie that wasn't going to enable him and didn't enable him. Or was not going to enable him, and Alfred was willing to continue enabling him until the point when he believed that Bruce was going to destroy himself. Mm-hmm. So
there, it's a bit of a trade-off back and forth with these two, but and here's the knee brace I was talking about that sounds like it's like snapping bone into place.
Not to interrupt you, Russell, but I just missed another foreshadowing line here where they're talking about
the autopilot.
autopilot function that has been broken for months.
Simply calling the what we know as the Batwing as just the Bat. Mm-hmm. And whatever. Call it whatever you want. It's the Batwing. And
I never really viewed it as the Batwing, because I guess when I think of the Batwing, I think of a traditional like plane or whatever, and I kind of viewed this as like its own thing unto itself. You know, like I think it's as unique to this as the Tumbler is to the Batmobile. Like I view them as different, separate entities at this point.
And maybe I still view the Tumbler as a Batmobile.
Yeah,
I just view it as a version of the Batwing, and I view this as a version of the Batwing personally.
Mm-hmm. Same. And when I'm looking at all this, like we were just in the R&D, the unofficially shut down R&D bunker with Lucius, and you see all this gear laying around, including a few extra tumblers, and I'm thinking, you never thought to just paint an extra one black and, you know, move it back in? I mean, you may need it. And, I mean, you fixed everything else. This seems like it would have been the easiest thing to take care of. Hey, Lucius, I busted the other one. Can we get another one of those, like all marked up and painted?
I love also
how
Bruce isn't even bothering to come up with legitimate, realistic excuses to Lucius anymore. He's just outright telling him, "All right, this is what I need."
I think they're past the point of pretense by now. They can just say, We're good here. I know you're Batman. I know what you need. I'll help you out. Just straight up say it at this point, because we went through the whole like asshole accountant lawyer dude figuring all this out in the last movie. I think we know how to handle this if it ever happened again. So we're okay. And apparently this universe is major stock exchange exists in Gotham City, but you know what? That's okay. Of course it does. And I always thought this was a really great action sequence. Maybe one that doesn't get talked about. Yeah. It doesn't get talked about enough, but this is of course it's the lead up to it now, but this big chase sequence that's going to occur is pretty badass. And
speaking of badass, this motorcycle helmet that's about to come off. Yeah.
Yep. Tremendous. Comes off. And then we see Bane wrecking shop on people for the first time in this movie. Like, we've seen him do other stuff, but we haven't seen him just like beat people down. And now it's like, yep, he is just kicking ass, and these people stood no chance.
We haven't mentioned, I don't think, in either of our first two reviews, very much anyway, the music and how much the score in these movies builds the tension and actually enhances the story, in my opinion, because the music of Hans Zimmer throughout these three movies, it creates this aura in each scene, and in this film, it builds this sense of anticipation that you know something big is coming. This confrontation between Batman and Bane is coming, and you get the feeling that there's this sense of dread about you. What do you guys make about Hans Zimmer and his contributions to this one, and then also for the other two movies as well, just the trilogy as a whole, because we really haven't talked enough, in my opinion, about him.
Have you noticed that the Batman theme that's used throughout this trilogy evolves as it goes? Mm-hmm. And it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until in this movie it finally reaches its apex. It reaches what it was always what it was meant to be, and is this like fully engaged, wide sprawling orchestral piece that will shake you all the way to your core. And that's something I really appreciate about Hans Zimmer's aesthetics, as it were, and as a composer and as a songwriter, because he took something very simplistic in Batman Begins, evolved it a bit for The Dark Knight. It was still recognizable from the previous film, but he added a few more bells and whistles and a few other little pieces into it. But by the time he got to The Dark Knight Rises, it was like he had this whole other layer of music that he wanted to put in with it. At its core, it's still the same theme from Batman Begins, but by the time you get to Rises, it is it sounds like a full symphony orchestra in full flight. And that for me is kind of puts it up there on that same level as the Danny Elfman Batman theme, which I still absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely love. But when you hear the version of the Batman theme from Dark Knight Rises, it's like, this is iconic. It is absolutely chill inducing.
It is. And what I love how Zimmer and Nolan, their sensibilities meld together like some of the great director and composer pairings over the years. You think of Spielberg and Williams, you know, where it's just that what Nolan wants the story to do, Zimmer gets, and he understands how to get that across to the audience. But yeah, this action scene is tremendous. It's tense. It sets up the current status quo in Gotham, because the other thing we haven't really talked about is this is a little bit of, not a little bit, this is very much, as The Dark Knight was at its time, an analogy of things that were going on in the real world. This is as well, about Occupy Wall Street was a thing around this time. It's showing the divide in Gotham between the poor and the very wealthy, and how that is leading to this almost civil war within Gotham.
Yeah, there was a line from Bane, actually, that put it up very succinctly, as he's seemingly robbing the stock exchange, but there's this one trader on the floor who looks at him and says, there's no money here. There's nothing to steal, there's no money here. And Bane looks right at him and is like, then why are you all here?
Yep.
So that's... That, I think, is a great illustration. And we also talked about that little EMP device from earlier. He's got a slightly bigger version of it now as Batman makes his first full appearance in the movie.
And I love the excited cop. Get ready for this. Yeah.
Yeah, as a kid, you're in for a show. Batman makes his first appearance in the movie over 46 minutes in. And I know that was a complaint that I definitely heard a lot about from people who were not digging on this movie. Personally, I was already so emotionally invested in everything else that was happening, they could have waited a full hour, and I still would have been on board.
Absolutely. No, 100%. That's the thing. Like, I can understand that, you know, to a degree. If the movie is not working, if the movie's not good, then yes, I might have a problem with Batman not showing up. But as it is, as the third movie in a series, which is how you have to view this one, I think it's important to establish everything that we've seen before we get to Batman. We need to know who Selina Kyle is. We need to know who Bane is, to a degree. We need to know why Bruce is in the situation that he's in and what his mindset is going in to the conflict of this movie. And I think they've done a good job of laying it out. Nick, your thoughts on that aspect?
Yeah, I mean, it's a story. Like, they're telling a story of a Bruce Wayne who has been, you know, driven away from his entire life. He has shut himself away from not just his personal life, but his life as Batman. And it's not something that you just flip the switch on. You know, it wouldn't make sense in the context of this character-driven story that they're trying to tell for you to open the movie up, show him as a recluse, and then 15 minutes later, here's Batman. Like, people need to have a little bit of patience with this thing. And also, you know, we've talked about the parallels between this and Batman Begins. I'd be interested to go back and look and see what the timestamp is on the first time Batman mm-hmm. himself makes his official appearance into the film, and I have a pretty good inclination it's probably pretty damn
close. It's going to mirror pretty closely.
Yeah, yeah. It is actually. I seem to recall it being about 45 minutes to an hour into the film before you actually see him in full Batman garb. Mm-hmm. And this is another... interesting bit about setting up the status quo of Gotham. Greg, you're absolutely right that this shows exactly where everybody is and where the mentality is of the Gotham City Police, as these guys who have just robbed and are actually continuing to rob through Wi-Fi the stock exchange from Gotham. Specifically, they're stealing Bruce Wayne's money. But instead of pursuing the people who just committed a crime right in front, in full view of the GCPD, as soon as Batman's on the scene, their captain orders them to drop everything and chase Batman. The guys who were stealing money, the guys who were actually really committing a crime and did right in front of you, and you decide that chasing Batman was more important. And John Blake is seemingly the only one who seems to have a problem with it. He's calling it out like, you know, hey, the bad guy's getting away. What are we doing?
Which is a nice kind of evolution of where we had, it, on some level, where we had Jim Gordon in the first movie as almost the lone good cop in a department full of, in that movie, corrupt cops, and in this movie, lazy cops in large part.
You've got to,
or at least in administration, not the ground level cops as much.
They're very much invested in chasing Batman. It looks like the entire freaking police force is after this one guy.
Right.
But to me, it feels like this captain is just is letting his ambition cloud his better judgment. But of course, this is Batman we're talking about. You guys cornered him in an alley. He's getting out of that. We're about to get our first full look at the Bat
This is so good.
He's like a rat in a trap. I totally got him. No, you don't. Light comes on. Here comes the Bat. And that thing's awesome. And then Batman just flies away while everybody just stands there dumbfounded. All that's missing is for someone to ask, where does he get those wonderful toys?
Wonderful toys. And this also leads to another of my favorite scenes. Pretty much all the Catwoman scenes in this movie are up there for me. She's in a bad way. Bruce rescues her. And here's something else that is a nice... It's a small thing, but it demonstrates the growth of Batman over the course of this trilogy. Because in the midst of this big knockdown, drag-out fight with Bane's henchmen, Catwoman grabs a gun and is going to use it, and Batman takes it from her and says, no killing.
Yeah, it's such a little thing, but it's a great, I think, dynamic between their two characters, showing the difference between them. But this is also right around the first time that we see Batman in full garb is the first time we see Selina in full Catwoman garb.
Mm-hmm. And I'm good with it.
Perfectly, because she fills out the cat suit quite nicely. And I appreciate, where some might not, that her mask and goggles form cat ears.
Yes.
And she can flip them down around her eyes. I'm assuming that gives her more something akin to night vision if she needs it.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least just eye protection, because otherwise that mask is pretty open.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I agree completely, Russell. I thought it was a nice and a cool homage to say, you know, to her Catwoman costume. And I think, honestly, that's about as accurate as they could have gotten with the Catwoman costume in the context of this movie. This is, you know, a different world. This is which comes on every week after the Cosby Show. And it's a world all its own. And I think that her suit is about as good as I could have imagined for a Catwoman suit to look in the modern era, at least in the Nolanverse.
The suit's right on. The heels might be a little impractical,
right?
But she does use them to pretty good effect in the scene just before we get to this like big knockdown dragout fight, when she's holding Daggett's wrist or kind of holding his hand up to the wall. Mm-hmm. She uses her heels to hold him there, and apparently they're a little bladed too, because it was seemingly causing him a little extra pain. So the heels do have a use, though. It's, man, she's got to have some serious skills to be able to run in those things.
No kidding. Yeah, I would agree. That is definitely the unpractical part of the costume. But yeah, so all of this is working and building up to this scene where Bruce and Selina kind of meet each other in their I guess formal wear for the first time.
And the whole getting into cars with strange men bit I thought was funny.
Yes, absolutely. And just how nonchalant Bane is the whole time. Like,
yeah,
completely unintimidated. Maybe the first time Batman's encountered someone other than the Joker who is completely not intimidated by him in any manner.
That's kind of a running thing in these movies. The only time that people ever seemed intimidated by Batman was in Batman Begins. Because as Maroney points out in The Dark Knight, they're wise to your act. You got rules. They know how far you'll go.
Good point.
And then by Dark Knight Rises, I don't know that any of Bane's thugs are really all that intimidated by Batman. They're far more scared of Bane.
Right. Bane has commanded them, and he has no fear of reprisal from anyone for anything he's doing. So he's walking around, you know, hands kind of tucked in his vest, you know, just completely not worried about anything around him.
I mean, it's his yard now.
He's the big dog.
He is the big dog, and he knows it. He walks around fully confident in that fact that, you know what, Batman may have been good, but as Bane rightly points out, victory has defeated you.
Yes, yes. So let's kind of start working our way through. We like to talk about the performances in all our off-the-page movies, and we've already talked about some here in some standpoints. But let's start at the very top with Christian Bale as Batman in this movie, because I remember when we left the theater the first time I saw this, I remarked to someone, I think this might be his strongest performance across the three movies because of how much he's asked to do here. Mm-hmm. Because he's portraying both a weak Batman at the beginning and a strong Batman at the end. He's portraying a guy who goes through the gamut of emotions. We see him at his angriest in this movie. We see him at his saddest in this movie. And finally, we see him at his most heroic in this movie. I really thought the one thing that anything else over these rewatches, I've come to reappreciate Christian Bale's performances. But in this one, he's just fantastic from beginning to end, I think. Nick, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, he's got a range here. He's got to take this character on a journey, you know. Probably more character development for Bruce Wayne in this movie than you have in any other. I mean, you could make the argument for Batman Begins, but that's kind of using snapshots from throughout Bruce's life rather than one narrative journey of character development. This is a broken Bruce who finds self-destruction and then redemption and then the true meaning of heroism and manages to, you know, lose and regain everything along the way. And we would be very remiss here, Greg, if we didn't take a moment to mention the wonderful turn that Michael Caine is giving, playing Adrian, actually, from Rocky with the "You Can't Win" speech. And now, you're about to get one of the first of two, like, emotional Michael Caine gut punches in the film, as he's gonna have the reveal of what really happened with Rachel Dawes in The Dark Knight, and we're gonna see Bruce's reaction to that.
Man, if you can watch this scene between these two guys giving these performances with this script and not get somewhat emotional, you are a stronger and better man than I, because I can't get through this scene without getting emotional whenever I watch it. It's two phenomenal actors at their absolute best, to the point where I don't see Christian Bale and Michael Caine in the scene. I see Bruce Wayne and Alfred, and I view it in that context. And Michael Caine's Alfred, as we talked about, is the heart of this Batman trilogy in many ways. And when he is happy, I'm happy. And when he is sad, I'm sad. And to see the heartbreak in his eyes and to hear the heartbreak in his voice as he gives Bruce some tough love here that he hopes will have some effect on him. And then to see Bruce just utterly broken and to see Bruce so callous and cold towards the man that's raised him since he was a child, because Bruce is hurt by something that he said. We've all been there with our families, with our friends, where we've said things we wish we could take back. And that's certainly the case with Bruce here. He's lashing out in anger and sadness. And it's a masterpiece of a scene.
Fully agreed. This was this was tough to watch in the theater the first time I was seeing this movie. Because he's really just, as you said perfectly, he's broken in a way that, you know, isn't sad. He's like, this is his anger, this is his cold and callousness coming out, and he's hitting Alfred with it. And then, of course, in this very next scene, Alfred is gone. But as Bruce wakes up to the doorbell ringing, he didn't actually expect Alfred to be gone. It's like he woke up and
he thought they were
maybe
having
thought,
a little lover's spat. And,
like he thought everything will be okay. We'll sleep on it and cooler heads will prevail in the morning. Well, ain't no cooler heads to be found here. Alfred's gone.
And full disclosure, that last scene was one of three times that I cried in the theater during this film. I'll admit that. I am man enough to admit that I cried three times during this movie. That was the first scene. I will mention the other two later time.
And then, of course, Bruce Wayne is also finding out here that he is now broke. Or that he is about to be.
And it's kind of interesting. He takes the tumble from the wealthy one percenter that is Batman. And by the end of the movie, who does he leave the Batman legacy to? A kid that came up through an orphanage that had nothing.
He left it to an orphan, like himself.
Like himself, yep. Someone that comes from significantly less than him.
Perhaps a
chance to take and accelerate the symbol to a new level.
I think that was the ultimate realization of the symbolism of Batman, the idea of Batman, that he could be... that Batman was just a symbol, that he could be anyone, so long as that person was truly dedicated to that cause. And he had hoped that it would be Harvey Dent, that he could retire the symbol of Batman. But I think in the course of this movie, Bruce really learns the power of that symbol, because it's a little thing, but you know the little kids are drawing the little Batman symbol using chalk,
mm-hmm.
and that's something that gets used a lot later in the movie. It's used to mark the path of these trucks that are moving around this decaying reactor that's eventually going to go nuclear. But I think Bruce comes to fully realize the power of the symbol he created, that there's never going to be a day when Gotham no longer needs a Batman. It's always going to need that symbol. That symbol means something to the people of Gotham. And in The Dark Knight, his idea was, I can find someone who works within the system and I can retire the bat altogether. But this take on it allows him to see that, no, you need to find a way to keep that symbol alive and allow it to evolve.
Yes.
And this kid, John Blake, is going to be the one to take it to that next level.
He realizes that Gotham does not need Bruce Wayne, but it definitely needs Batman.
Yep.
Just really good. Marion Cotillard, we haven't talked about her much. She plays a character in here that we're not, you know, we're not wise to her exact origins until close to the end of the movie, where it's revealed that she is playing Talia al Ghul, the daughter of Ra's al Ghul, who, of course, we met in the first movie, Batman Begins. And Talia, of course, is one of the most famous Batman villains / love interests in the comics and on the animated series, and kind of an unexpected, in some ways, usage of that character. And I think that they did a hell of a job with the swerve. The swerve was really well done, well acted, and I loved how they almost present a version of Talia that may even have a more corrupted vision than her father did in terms of what his ultimate goal was. Yes, he wanted to burn Gotham to the ground, but she almost seems to be taking a glee in it that mm-hmm. her father did not.
And she's not doing it for any noble purpose. She is not doing it so that Gotham can be raised and reborn anew, so that it can become, you know, a valuable contributor to the world. She was doing it because she is like the warped extension of her father's ideology. Like, she thinks she is paying homage to his legacy when really she is warping it for her own personal revenge-driven terms and has no real, even kind of misguided ethical, you know, reasoning behind it. It's a really good interpretation of the character, even though I will say I think Marion Cotillard's performance is actually stronger before the Talia reveal, because I think if you want to criticize anything about this movie, I will say I think her death scene is a little weird.
Her death scene's bad, yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. It warrants criticism, and honestly, like, even her monologue before that is just, you know, good enough. I actually think she's a lot better playing it straight than she is playing the big villainess at the end.
I would say that I agree with you on the death scene. I actually like her monologue at the end, though. Like, not before she dies, but the one that she's where she explains herself to Bruce and turns on him. I liked how she did that. But I can see where you're coming from. And certainly, the death scene is the one thing in this movie that I can't really. I can pretty passionately defend everything else. I can't defend that.
No, that death is certainly bad. Though the one part of the movie that really takes you out of it there for a second, and it's a good thing it's placed where it is, because otherwise you might be like, uh-oh.
and it's in the context of you get the great Gordon scene right there around it. which is one of, I know, might be Nick's favorite, or one of Nick's favorite scenes in the entire trilogy. Mm-hmm.
Leave it to Gary Oldman to bring it back. I have, as we're recording this, this is the official 10th anniversary of The Dark Knight. It was released 10 years ago exactly today, and my love of Gary Oldman's take on Commissioner Gordon has only grown over the years. He is kind of the linchpin, the stitching that pulls this movie together.
He's outstanding throughout the entire trilogy, and as much as ever in this one.
His performance here is just so freaking good. It's one of those where you've seen this mighty hero rise and fall in a very similar way to how Batman rose and fell. He starts off in a pretty dark place at the beginning, trying to figure out just exactly how he can make a difference. You see him much more confident and assured in the second film, but also someone who's willing to sacrifice maybe a little too much to get the job done. And then here in Dark Knight Rises, you get to see the full toll of what that sacrifice has meant. And it's the parallel stories between Bruce Wayne and Commissioner Gordon that add that extra thick layer of great storytelling to this film trilogy for me.
Oh yes, and I love his dynamic here with John Blake, where it kind of makes Gordon realize that, you know what, I have compromised myself along the way. I made mistakes. I did what I thought I had to do, and it kind of led us to this position. And it also informs John Blake and kind of makes John Blake realize that maybe the police force isn't the way for me to affect change in Gotham.
It's true.
really good layers here. Speaking of layers, Bruce is a layer of women, as we're about to see.
Yes. He racks up quite a few in his time.
And so this is, again, all part of the long game, so to speak, for Talia. Mm-hmm. We don't know how long it is, actually. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that. But I'm going to assume it's the long game for Talia here, and as part of her plan. So we talked a little bit about Christian Bale. Russell, did you have anything you wanted to add about him before we move to other performances?
Well, I agree with you guys. I think that this is his overall best performance of the entire trilogy is here. This is, whereas, you know, Heath Ledger was stealing the show in The Dark Knight, and of course we were all just kind of getting used to him being Batman and Batman Begins, this is Bruce Wayne and Batman fully realized, and Christian Bale absolutely confident and comfortable in the role. He brings all sorts of interesting emotional depth and layers to this performance, as he tends to do in most movies he's in. But this one is his. This is the part where he puts his stamp on this role going forward. This is where he is fully the Batman.
Yeah, this is. It's going to define. The thing about Christian Bale is he's had so many outstanding roles and so many different varied roles in his career that he's managed to escape the trap of being typecast. However, this is the role that he's going to be remembered for in generations. Batman. You can't play Batman and not be remembered for it, for better or for worse.
That's very true, but at least he played it well.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And speaking of played it well, we talked about Anne Hathaway as Catwoman. I feel like we've kind of said our piece on her. She did an outstanding job in this movie. We haven't talked much about Tom Hardy, and I really want to because I have a few things that kind of trigger me related to this movie. And one of them is the criticism of Bane, because while, yes, there is nothing more fun than other than maybe doing a Joker voice than doing a Bane voice. It's I love it. It's great.
It's not great.
Yes. All you have to do is watch the Trip guys. For those who know who we're referring to, the guys from the Trip do their Bane voices. Very, very funny. However, what I don't like is when I read criticism of Tom Hardy online for this performance, because I think, and again, this is coming from somebody that has been a Bane fan since 1993, I think it's a brilliant reimagining of this character. Because what Tom Hardy brings to it in terms of his nuance, his subtlety, his physical transformation, the fact that they find a practical reason for him to wear a mask, because if you're wanting him to wear a luchador mask, folks, I don't know what to tell you. There's no way he was going to be wearing a luchador mask in the Nolan trilogy. And they find a way to make the mask make sense. They find a way to make the mask work. There's a practical application to it. And here's the other thing. Tom Hardy has to go out there and put on a performance to follow the greatest performance of all time as the Joker. And he has to fill that shoes as the movie's primary antagonist and do it almost entirely with his eyes. And I think he's amazing at it. I want to draw particular attention to Bane's last couple scenes in the movie, the really last portion of the film, when Bane is beaten by Batman and he's laying on the ground and Talia has stabbed Batman and she's explaining how she escaped the pit, that it was her and not Bane that escaped the pit and that he stayed behind and suffered. I want anybody that's watching this movie, watch it to its fruition and look at Tom Hardy's eyes from the beginning of that scene to the end, and I think you will be blown away, because I'm blown away every time I watch it. I think it is it's not Ledger, but nothing is, by the way, but it is a freaking masterful performance, and it's what made me fall in love with Tom Hardy as an actor.
The brutal manner in which Bane moves, and I'm talking about the way he's fighting here. We're seeing the scene of him and Batman having their first fight, and he is just wrecking shop on Batman. He is not intimidated in the least. He lets Batman land.
No wasted movement.
None whatsoever. He lets Batman land all the hits he wants, and it's like, you know, you are just not capable of beating me. He knows from the start of this fight that he's got Batman's number. And
Michael Cole would say that he's building momentum.
I'd say he came into the fight with all the momentum, and Batman is just so out of his depth here. He has no idea who he's up against, and even in a couple of moments where it seems like he might be getting the upper hand, it's not even remotely close to that. Bane is a force of nature here, and the way Tom Hardy moves, like keeping the shoulders hunched, letting you see just how big he is, like how top-heavy he is, He is just unstoppable. This is a man born to beat people.
You wouldn't believe that this is the same Tom Hardy from Inception.
Not at all. Vastly different character and played even better than it. I love his character in Inception, but my God, his take on Bane is just so perfect. And it's so very different from the comics as well. It's finding its own voice. It is a unique take on the character, but it's one that I feel like Ledger's Joker was a very unique take on the character, one that we had never seen in comics or anywhere really before. That's what makes this version of Bane work, because this is not a version that you're likely to see anywhere other than
exactly. That is, I'm so glad you said that, Russell. That is perfect, because it is the perfect Bane for this story. It is a reimagining of this character in a way that works, frankly, to a degree that doing a direct adaptation of a classic comics version would not have. It still captures the essence of Bane. It captures what he was originally created as, which so many people in the comics and the cartoons and everywhere else have forgotten over the years, is that Bane is not supposed to be a one-dimensional, purely physical threat. Bane is also a mental threat. Bane is also an emotional threat. Bane is also a calm, collected, a guy that has power, but doesn't just have power because of his physicality. His physicality is a huge part of it, but people forget he also outsmarted Batman in the comics at one point before Batman got wise to him. So like that's something that they capture here, and they ratchet it up and use their own sensibilities to craft this new version of Bane that to me works perfectly.
I am fully on board with this. And Nick, what did you think of this take on Bane?
Oh man, it was outstanding. I mean, like you guys have said, it's a complete reinvention. You know, it's not, if you're looking for the luchador mask and you're looking for the traditional Venom and the, you know, the drug abuse kind of story, it's not here. Now, granted, you have the mask and, you know, references to the fact that it helps him deal with pain that keeps elements of that in. But what this does is really highlight an aspect of Bane that I think a lot of people miss, is that Bane's not just a mindless brute. He's very, very intelligent. And in this film, we get to see a guy who's got these plans, who's got, you know, these deeply laid out machinations that are all coming to fruition, and everything is pretty much going the way he expected it to. Now, you can make an argument that Talia is the true brains of the operation, but I get the impression from the film that they were much more partners than master and subordinate necessarily.
Oh, certainly. She had to trust Bane to run a long segment of this operation, because she was going to have to maintain her cover and like play her role to its full end. That meant that Bane was going to be running the day-to-day operation of moving them into position for what they ultimately planned to do. So if Bane was not a smart guy and a capable leader, it would never have worked. Mm-hmm. So he's absolutely, I would say I'm having trouble like gauging exactly where I would place his intelligence, but he outsmarts Bruce here. He didn't just beat him down. He had him like figured from the second he laid eyes on him. Like he knew how to beat both Bruce Wayne and Batman, and does it in pretty spectacular fashion.
Yeah, he knows exactly what move Bruce is going to do before he does it.
And now we're up to the part where Bruce is now inside the pit. The pit where Talia and Bane were both kind of forged. And this is where Bruce will be for about a year. People forget that.
Yeah.
There's a year of time in this movie. Like, we've spent all this time building this story, but now we're about to go through kind of the the comeback Rocky montage that just takes a lot longer because we actually fit in with, instead of using Hearts on Fire, we actually have, some story here.
Right, right. No Hearts on Fire here. Instead, we get backs being broken and put back in place. So, which is another thing we have to mention here. The surprise appearance in ghostly form of Ra's al Ghul. What did you guys make of Liam Neeson reprising his role as Ra's, if only in Bruce's mind?
Yeah, that had leaked out before this movie came out that he was going to be there.
But nobody really knew the context.
Nobody really knew the context. And when he first pops up on screen, I actually bit on it. I thought they were actually going to do the resurrection angle because we never actually, technically saw him die on screen. So it's always that that classic, if there's no body, there's no death kind of situation. But the way they do it makes perfect sense for the movie. It allows you to drive home that thematic connection between Batman Begins, and it just gives you another opportunity to get a glimpse at that really cool interpretation of a classic Batman character that we saw in Batman Begins and was cool to see back here again.
Yeah, completely agreed. And I'm always going to be happy whenever Liam Neeson's on my screen, so I was happy to see him pop up and to see how Bruce's image of Ra's is, that there's a portion of Bruce's psyche that wonders if Ra's might have won in the end, that Ra's might have been right about him, It's another good scene in a litany of them in this movie. The whole portion in the pit I love, and there are some who differ on that, but for me, I love this whole portion with Bruce in the pit learning these valuable lessons and also finding rediscovering exactly what it is that drives him and motivates him. And of course, one of the most heroic hero moments on film to me is Bruce finally climbing out of that pit. And you see the old man crying because someone's finally escaped after all these years. And it's incredible. And Bruce sends the rope down to them to help the others get out. I mean, it's incredible. Like, it's such a great scene to me. What do you guys make of that?
I'm right there with you. I absolutely love this this comeback moment because this was Bruce relearning not just how to be Batman, but this was him rediscovering his own humanity and finding that will to live. Because as Bane and Alfred both correctly pointed out, Bruce never moved on, and through victory, he was himself defeated. And he needed to be broken, both physically and emotionally, to build himself back up, to see if he still had the will to do it. And this has got to be his lowest point, that he's alone, broken, and at the bottom of the world.
He's been beaten and victimized.
Yes, he has been left to rot in this hole. How else, how would anyone else respond to this? They would probably just roll over and die. This is a moment to show that this is a man whose will to pull himself out of, absolute hell will overcome everything else. He will find a way back. And it takes him a while, of course, but when he does it, it is one of the most triumphant moments of this movie.
Completely agree. And so let's move on and talk about some of the other performances here. Michael Caine as Alfred is so consistent throughout all these movies. And I'll go ahead and say now the other two scenes that made me cry in this movie. Okay, the next one is going to be the scene after Bruce is believed to be dead at the end of the movie. And Alfred is at the gravesite of the Waynes, and that's the scene where he breaks down and he says, "I failed you," talking to the graves of Thomas and Martha Wayne. That one made me cry because, again, seeing Alfred completely break down and completely broken and rattled with guilt, is an emotionally terrifying experience. And then I'll save the last moment for a little bit later. But Michael Caine as Alfred, any comments on him that aren't just trudging over old ground at this point, Nick?
No, I mean, we've talked about, you know, in various different podcasts and various different, you know, forums that we love his performance so much in this movie. You know, it's one of the rare instances where I think Dark Knight is the best movie in this trilogy and is the best made movie in this trilogy. But there are a couple of instances, the two biggest ones being Christian Bale and Michael Caine, where the best performances are actually given here in Dark Knight Rises, because Michael Caine, while he provides, you know, a great conscience for Bruce and a great grounding of the film in the first two in the first two films, he really brings the emotional resonance to this one in a way that drives home what they're attempting to do with the story. The audience's journey with Bruce doesn't work without Michael Caine's performance in this movie, and he absolutely knocks it out of the park.
100% agreed. Russell?
Yes to all. Because I think we've said it about Michael Caine. The guy is a linchpin of this series. He is something that if he weren't there, this just wouldn't work quite nearly as well as it does. And kind of right there with you, Greg. He's there to make you laugh for a while, but in this one, Alfred was here to make sure that some tears were flowing at some point. That was his job, and he performed it admirably.
Yeah, and the duality of Alfred viewing himself as the surrogate father for Bruce and the pain of a father losing a son, and the even greater pain of feeling like it was his fault that he lost his son. It's just an agonizing experience to watch. Moving across the board, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, you talked about him earlier, Russell. You're a big fan of his.
Oh, yes.
And he was outstanding in this as John Blake. And when we were talking about Nick was just talking about how The Dark Knight is the best of the three movies. And I can acknowledge that, yes, The Dark Knight is the best of the three movies. But my favorite of the three movies, I go back and forth between this and Dark Knight. And the reason is my emotional attachment to the story that this movie tells. So, and part of that, and I'll kind of get into my other reasoning at the end of the show, which will be coming up soon, but because we're going a little long. But Dick Grayson, That emotional resonance there. And if it was a ho-hum performance, I probably wouldn't care that much. But he goes out and he plays, as you mentioned earlier, Russell, he portrays the attitude of Dick Grayson combined with the detective skills of Tim Drake, the background of Jason Todd. And he does it in a way that is so convincing that I believe, and my heart pumps during the scene when Bruce escapes the pit, but my heart also pumps out of my chest in the closing shot of this film, as you see John Blake ascend into the Batcave, and whether he's going to become Batman, whether he's going to become Nightwing, whatever he's going to become, you know that this is the future and that this is the legacy of the Bat and that this is what this whole series has been building to, and it is breathtaking. And to me, it wouldn't work as well. It would still work probably, but it wouldn't work as well with a different, lesser performance in that role.
I am right there with you. I guess, can we go ahead and just address that moment, that big moment when...
That's the third moment for me.
Yes. when Bruce has, you know, left all these things in his will to Alfred and to everyone else, but he left something special for John Blake. And when he goes to claim it, he's given notice that he has something left to him by Bruce Wayne, but in order to claim it, he has to use his real name, which is revealed to be Robin. And I mean, people can say whatever they want to about that, but I actually really loved that little bit. That little moment just really hit with me. And then in order to get where he's going, he's given this just carry on, or this little gym bag or whatever, and it has like cave diving equipment in it, because the manor, Wayne Manor itself, has been turned into a new home for boys, because the old one was pretty much being shut down. So that's what Bruce Wayne did, was turned it into the Thomas and Martha Wayne home for, I guess, for orphans. Like, it's an orphanage now, which is a beautiful thing to wind up doing with Wayne Manor. And that moment when John Blake uses that equipment and the coordinates that he's given to find the back entrance of the cave, finds his way into it, and stands on that platform after he fires up the little light, the floodlight he's given, and the bats fly out and kind of surround him a little bit. But in that last moment, the closing shot of the film is him standing on the platform that will raise him up to the desk, like the main area of the Batcave. And then we fade to black. The movie is over. But that's...
Oh, man, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, Russell. It's like the... It's as far as just a moment that inspires me, I can't think of a scene in a movie that has done that more for me. I remember sitting in the theater as the movie ended, and I almost wanted to cry again because I was just so happy. It was just... It was a cathartic experience for me to see that happen, to see that... And even that... And yeah, maybe part of that is that there's that thought in the back of my mind, like, my God, what if they back a dump truck up to Nolan and get him to come back again and and do a movie with the new Batman, you know? Like,
just it would be everything that you and I have talked about actually, like, happening in the comics, something that has so rarely ever been a thing for any character. I mean, yes, we saw it happen with when Wally West became the Flash and was allowed to grow up and become that role. He was... the Flash, having never really met Barry Allen. We're talking from 1986 to 2011. That's a long time. But that's something that's never really happened for Dick Grayson, for Jason Todd, Tim Drake. We've gotten teases of it with Dick Grayson, where every so often he'd put on the cape and cowl, but he would go back to being Nightwing. There was never a sense of permanence to it. And even in films, whenever you think that, oh, you play by different rules when it comes to movies, because you can give characters endings. That's something that comics very rarely will truly allow you to have, because these characters are going to go on and on and on. They're going to outlive us all, as they have. I mean, you got a character like Batman who's going on like 80 years of history. That's a long time. But he's always been Bruce Wayne. But this movie decides to give us something completely different. It decides that it's time to give Batman that kind of ending and new beginning in a way that has never been before, by allowing Bruce Wayne to ride off into the sunset, and for our, in this, as in my mind, it goes, this version of Dick Grayson to take on that role, to be the legacy of the Bat, to take on that mantle and graduate on up to being the hero that we always knew he could be. The whole point of Batman taking him under his wing, so to speak, was to allow him to become a better Batman than he ever was or ever could be. And this movie, by the time it reaches that point, it gives us that. It gives us that guy, that person, that character who adopts that mantle and truly becomes a hero that will likely surpass the one who came before him.
And it continues the themes of Batman Begins of symbol, and yep. it does, to your point, it does what the comics have never been able to do by their nature, or at times what they have not had the guts to do. And that is to give us a coda to this movie that is a happy ending for Batman. And I don't mean the massage happy ending, although I'm sure he gets those too. I mean an actual happy ending, in that you get to the end of the movie and you see Bruce, his heroism, even in, quote, death, where he creates the orphanage. You know, he gives Alfred the ability to travel the world and live his rest of his life in luxury. He gives back to the community. He leaves the Batman legacy to a new generation because he understands that this whole franchise has been about creating a symbol that can inspire the people of Gotham to rise up and build themselves back up and build the city into what it should be, not about doing it for them. And ultimately, it gives Bruce Wayne a chance to finally have happiness. It gives us the one thing we've never seen before, outside of perhaps the 60s, a happy Batman. And a genuinely, fully happy Batman, where he's settled down with Selina. They're traveling the world. He looks healthy. He looks happy. He's retired. He's able to enjoy. And Earth 2 did that in the 70s. They got married, that Huntress and all that stuff. But even that ended up in tragedy, I think, where they got killed. So, you know, this is just giving us a chance to end on a positive note, a story about a character so seeped in tragedy.
And not to get off topic or anything, but one story that, like, we've mentioned several stories that this movie obviously takes big cues from, but there's one that I think, one major story that we failed to mention that it takes a huge cue from, and that is No Man's Land. Because at this point in the movie, Gotham is completely cut off from the rest of the world and is allowed to kind of fall to ruin in a way. So it takes big cues there, and it's also another reason why I think that it's very tragic that Heath Ledger was not able to be a part of this film, because the Joker actually has a pretty big role in that story, and I think that he would have here as well.
Yeah. Which, that's a good point, Nick, that you brought up earlier. How do you think the Joker would have shaped this narrative?
It's so hard to say, because Nolan is a guy who's never really talked about it. He doesn't really talk about the story development process for any of his films. My assumption is that because part of the movie, you know, part of the of Bane's plot is talking about turning the people of Gotham against the established order and against Batman, that the Joker would have played a role in that, and that he would have been loosely allied with Bane as something of a, you know, a Pied Piper whispering these, you know, unpleasant truths in the ears of various citizens and be seen as a public figure on that level. And I think there's no doubt in my mind anyway, he would have played a much larger role in the film than the other villain return we wind up getting here later on, Cillian Murphy's Scarecrow does. But it's just so hard to say. And I think, like you brought up last time, Greg, undoubtedly there would have been a scene with Christian Bale and Heath Ledger that would have been nothing but probably, you know, in my mind, it's kind of like a recreation of the interrogation scene, except the other way around this time, where Joker is going, "I told you so," essentially. Like, look at everything you did and look at where it got you. It got you nowhere.
Ultimately, these people ate each other.
Yep, and he would have just, like, verbally berated Batman in the course of that scene. I think that probably would have happened. You know, but it's just so hard to say. It is, in my mind anyway, the greatest what if in comic book movie history.
Now, I want to give you a chance to talk about any of the performances that really stood out to you that you wanted to get to. Because, you know, I'm running through lists in my mind, and I can't think of anyone that I haven't brought up yet that's a major, huge. I mean, I guess the police captain, he's really good.
Yeah,
but
he's fine. Yeah, he serves a role. You know, it's a decent performance. You guys have covered it so well, but I'll throw love to one in particular that, even though you guys have talked about him, I mean, Gary Oldman in this movie cements the fact that he's not just the greatest Jim Gordon we've ever seen on screen. He might be the best Jim Gordon we've seen in general. Like, this interpretation of it, the way they use him in this story, and of course, that closing scene with he and Bruce is just so damn well done that it was one of the moments that made me well up in the theater. You know,
I remember.
The John Blake rising up doesn't really elicit that, you know, that wellspring of emotion, but the Michael Caine stuff and Jim Gordon, you know, Bruce and Jim Gordon with the line about, you know, putting a coat around a young boy's shoulders to let him know the world hadn't ended, that's what gets me, because that's a relationship I've always been a big mark for. So, Gary Oldman, you know, I think there's a strong argument to be made here as well, that despite the fact that Dark Knight is the best of the movies, you could argue Gary Oldman gives his best performance in this film.
Oh, it's incredible that the relationship between he and Bruce, the relationship between him and John Blake, he does an amazing job here. I'm glad that you shouted him out. Well, let's kind of try to wrap a little bit of a bow on this and talk about our just general overall impressions of this movie. I'll save my thoughts for just a minute later, and I'll go ahead and I'll let you, Nick, talk about what you think about The Dark Knight Rises. You mentioned, I think last week, you hit it heavily at it, and I think you said at the top of the show that it's your second favorite comic book movie. Is that correct?
It's not just my second favorite comic book movie. It's my second favorite movie of all time. Like, you can call me a Mark or a Homer or whatever you want to call me, and I'll own all those terms. I will let you throw those at me and take them on willingly. The Chris Nolan trilogy is not just my favorite, you know, trilogy in comic book movies. It's my favorite trilogy in all of film. The three individual entries are legitimately my three favorite movies of all time. I would rather watch these three movies than anything else on the face of this planet. And if I'm ranking them, I go Dark Knight at one, I go Batman Begins at three, which means I go Dark Knight Rises at two. It's my second favorite movie of all time. I think there are things you can sit here, and if you really, really, really want to nitpick, you can find things to nitpick about any movie, and this is no exception. But I think if you are doing that, you're just setting out to be a douche and not actually having, you know, legitimate issues with the movie. I love this movie.
This isn't the first time anyone's done a trilogy.
What does that mean? Oh, I get you. I see what you did there.
Little throwback to real life.
Yeah, to real life. No, it's not the first time anybody's done a trilogy, but it's the best anybody's ever done a trilogy, so I'm gonna fucking praise it. So
yes.
It's the best trilogy of all time. Give me any of these movies over the entirety of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I stand by that.
Strong words from a strong man, Captain Insano. And for the record, and again, please, anyone listening, don't take this as a knock, because I love the MCU, which you can hear all about in our series Hard Travelers for Hire, which... spoiler alert, Russell will be joining us for in the very near future.
Guys, we wouldn't do Hard Travelers for Hire if we didn't love the MCU.
But I agree with you. I'm in the same spot as you, man. This is my series. I think my appreciation for Batman Begins has only gone up in viewing all three of these movies so close together, because to me it's the best superhero story on screen. It's the one that I am emotionally connected to the most. The performances, the writing, the sound, everything across the board. And yeah, this movie for me, I think I kind of mentioned it earlier, that it's a cathartic type movie for me, because the main things about this, I mentioned my emotional ties to the story that they're telling. Dick Grayson's my favorite character. Selina Kyle is my favorite female superhero. I'll go ahead and call her that in this context. But when you combine them together and you tell their stories and you get across the reasons that I love them, that's the other thing. It's not just the characters in name only. It's the characters and what I love about those characters, their attitudes, their personalities, how conflicted they are, particularly in Selina's case. When you combine that with telling a story about a character that matters so much to me in Batman and Bruce Wayne that I've looked at since I was a young kid as one of my favorite characters in all of fiction, and to see his story get told in this way, taking elements from the Batman book that defined my childhood, which was Nightfall, getting that villain so right, in my opinion, and in the end giving Batman a ride off into the sunset moment. I mean, it all combines to create a formula that's going to work for me. And there's my well-known love of finales. I love the closing chapter of a series. I'm a sucker for it. Return of the Jedi is my favorite Star Wars movie. Return of the King is my favorite Lord of the Rings movie. Bourne Ultimatum is my favorite Bourne movie. Like, I'm a sucker for the story coming full circle and for the happy ending. I just am. And for me, this movie just
strikes all the right chords for me. Again, I can't say that it's as good, quite as good as The Dark Knight, but it's damn close for me. I love it. Russell, your thoughts on the movie?
This is one of those rare trilogies that you can say is of a generation. Much like the original Star Wars trilogy was of the previous generation, I feel like, you know, people will assign it in different ways. Of course, some will say that Lord of the Rings is the is that version of the fantasy trilogy for that next generation. But I got to tell you, this one is the one that takes a character on a truly emotional, deep, and like life and like, even physical altering journey. Not unlike the journey we see Luke Skywalker go on in the original Star Wars trilogy. So this is, for me, the movie trilogy that fits into that slot for that next generation. It's the one that perfectly balances its storytelling, and from the opening of Batman Begins to the final scene of Dark Knight Rises, this is that movie that kind of defines a character, defines what it means to be this character. And probably for the first time ever in Batman history, it gives us a movie trilogy, or gives us a story on the big screen that is more focused on its titular hero than it is on the villains that surround him. This is Bruce Wayne's story. And it shows you that Bruce Wayne is as compelling a character and as interesting to watch on screen as any of his rogues gallery. Look, Batman has the greatest rogues gallery in the history of comics, bar none. And I say that as a Spider-Man fan, as Spider-Man comes first in my fandom. But when it comes to rogues galleries, give it to Batman. He's got it. He wins. But when it comes right down to it, Batman doesn't just have the best rogues gallery in comics. He might be the most complex character in comics. That's why he endures. That's why this trilogy is so well done, because it takes that into account. It doesn't just say, all right, well, everybody knows who Batman is, so I'm just going to have someone stand here and play the role. I mean, all respect and everything to Michael Keaton. But that's kind of what he was doing. He wasn't really putting much into playing Bruce Wayne, but he was doing a fine job of standing there and looking intimidating in a bat suit. So, you know, congratulations, but that's a Joker movie. This is a Batman movie. Christian Bale fully realizes the character in all of his aspects, in all three of his identities. The Bruce Wayne, who's the public face, the playboy billionaire, the real guy that he shows to those who know him best, like Alfred, like Rachel, and Lucius. Like, very few people actually see the real Bruce Wayne. And then there's the Bat, the demonic protector of Gotham, the Dark Knight detective. And you see all of these iterations of this character within this trilogy, in each of the movies too, as this character evolves and finds that voice. That is why this is the greatest superhero trilogy of all time, and it's going to be sometime, I think, before anyone is ever able to even come close to this.
Absolutely. And I want to close. I agree with you, everything you just said. That was perfect, because I echo it completely. I want to close this with, we've talked about The Dark Knight Rises, we've talked about the trilogy, and the one thing that we've talked about throughout Dark Knight Month is how this trilogy defines this character for us and defines, in many ways, our comic book movie fandom. And while we have seen an enormous success with the MCU, certainly, and the many franchises within the MCU, such as Captain America being the standout. But obviously DC has struggled. DC has even struggled with Batman in terms of getting a consistent tone, getting a story that's compelling. What do you think it would take for a movie franchise, and you can't just say Christopher Nolan. I guess what is at the heart of these movies that makes them endure, that makes them stand out beyond just the fact that Batman's a great character? In terms of the approach to the filmmaking, what do you hope that future filmmakers can take out of this trilogy?
Story first. I mean, this is a story you could tell if you wanted to tell it about a street-level vigilante not named Batman. You could probably tell this story. It doesn't hinge upon the fact that it is Batman. It being a licensed story enhances it for sure. But Chris Nolan started with a hell of a story idea and a hell of a take. He wasn't preoccupied with working with fitting in Easter eggs. I mean, think about how many times throughout this trilogy fans went, "Oh, that has to be an Easter egg. That has to be set up for something else coming, you know, five movies down the road," and then it never happened. Like, he wasn't occupied or obsessed with setting up the next thing. He wasn't obsessed with establishing a shared universe in the first, you know, the first fucking movie of his franchise. He was obsessed with telling a coherent and logical story. Do that first, everything else can fall into place.
I agree with that. And I would also say that know what audience you're trying to reach with your movie. Because that's something I feel like too many people, when they're telling their Batman stories or their Gotham stories, looking at a certain television show, you don't know who your audience is. You don't know who you're trying to reach. Christopher Nolan knew exactly what he was trying to do, knew exactly who he was trying to reach. There isn't a hint of Batman 66 in this entire trilogy. Not even a little. And look, no disrespect intended to Batman 66. It played its role. It is what it is, and it is there for our enjoyment. But if you're trying to tell a Batman story in the modern era, you cannot mix two things that just don't go together. And I think that that's why this trilogy succeeds. Now, do you just ape this? Do you just ape Christopher Nolan? I think you could probably be moderately successful if you did. But I think you have to look back at some of the most successful comic book stories from Batman. Stories like Hush, stories like No Man's Land, like Batman Year One, like Long Halloween and Dark Victory. What do all these stories have in common? They have that sense of realism. Yeah, there's some fantastical stuff that's happening in there because they do occur in a larger superhero world. But one of the keys of making Batman work, one of the biggest aspects, or probably maybe the biggest aspect of why this character works on screen, is because he's human. He is a person who is using his wits, his own physical, admittedly almost super physical prowess, and gadgetry to do what he does. But these movies are grounded. These stories that I've just mentioned are very grounded. There's not a lot of like supernatural elements going on. You don't see alien invasions happening. And the stakes aren't world-ending. That's one of the biggest keys to making a successful Batman movie. And God, I hope Matt Reeves is tuned into that. Make it personal to Batman and Bruce Wayne. Keep it on that scale. Understand that that's where you're trying to tell your story and go forward from there. Don't feel like you have to save the fucking world every time you make one of these movies. You don't. You just need to make sure that your character feels authentic and that it feels like you took the source material seriously. If you do that, at least you won't make another Green Lantern.
Absolutely. And to build on what the two of you just said, story first. The importance of knowing your audience and knowing what story you're trying to tell. And I would also add, don't be a slave to any previous adaptation of the character, but understand the fundamental heartbeat of each character that you're adapting and what makes that character tick. The sense of justice, the sense of tragedy, the duality of his nature. If you get that, at least you're coming in with a strong base to focus on story first, to focus on all these other things, and do something that, again, it's going to be hard to ever exceed this trilogy, or to even match it. But I think that that's starting off on the right foot and taking away from this movie a greater lesson than just the tone of it. Because that's not what makes this movie succeed. What makes this movie succeed is the totality of the thought that went into making it. And I hope that we continue to see great amounts of thought being put into superhero movies going forward. Well, with that being said, let's wrap this thing up for now. Russell, thank you so much for joining us to talk about this movie. We really appreciate you coming on. And I know that people can contact you on Twitter, and you've got a few pretty exciting things coming up. I don't know if you're ready to announce all of them yet, but tell people how they can contact you and tell the people some of the things you might have on the way.
Well, you guys can always hit me up on the old Twitter machine at Russell_Sellers. I'm always on there saying a lot of dumb shit, usually about comics and, you know, comic book based movies, and getting into faux arguments with people who think they know better than me. But anyway,
Mike, I'm looking at you.
But I love Mike. I love our banter back and forth. It's fun. That's the primary thing. And, of course, you can find me monthly, twice monthly, over on the Marvel Age podcast, where we're talking all things Marvel Comics. And, of course, one half the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Nick Duke himself, is our grand leader. Our, I guess, would you be?
I wouldn't say that grand.
Well, I'm giving you some credit, though. You don't have enough hair to do the Grade Temples. So we're kind of stuck there, but yeah.
I would say if I had Grade Temples, they would be an homage to Gerard Jones, Hal Jordan, but that would carry some unfortunate connotations in this day and age, so I won't make that comparison.
Well, hey, we'll just say you're the Ric Flair of our Place to Be Nation Pops Four Horsemen.
You know, actually, that's pretty fair considering how many times you guys have seen my dick.
Things that we never thought we'd revisit in podcast form. The literal button on for code. But in any case, yes, you can find me there and making occasional appearances on Marvel Age Masterclass with Ben Morris, jumping around to other podcasts too. I'm sure I'll be making appearances on Geek and Sassy and Talking Pop. Who knows? It's all out there. And of course, listen out, there might actually be an ad popping up on some of these shows in the very near future that will give you guys a full taste of what it is I've got coming up next. But if you guys want to help me out and getting some word spread about that, start dropping that hashtag DC4U, and you guys will be looking out for some more stuff coming up in the very near future.
Looking forward to it, my friend. I trust that the Hard Traveling Fanboys will be cut in on a little bit of that action, but we'll cover that when the time comes. And speaking of ads, we got to pay the bills for our Russian overlords, so we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, Nick and I are going to be back with the rundown, reading and watching. You know the drill. Hard Traveling Fanboys coming right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. I have locked the Macho Man Randy Savage out of our studio this week. He will not be making any appearances. I don't know how he got in last week, frankly.
People will tell you that he's a paranoid guy who goes around questioning people's motives needlessly, but you literally just physically locked him out of our studios. How is he supposed to not question your motives at this point?
Well, I mean, listen, I did it based on his well-documented history of shoving announcers against the wall to the point that they doo-doo themselves.
Doo-doo, you mean?
Doo-doo. So we're going to start off the back half of the show here with our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. We skipped it last week, so we've got a little bit more than we typically do. And we are going to give you our segment called The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown. Where we talk some comic news. Welcome to The Rundown. Where we talk about movies too.
And leading us off this week on The Rundown, actually, I'm going to use this one just on account of the fact that it ties into our theme for this month. It is mm-hmm. Dark Knight month.
Mm-hmm.
And as we record this, it is Dark Knight Day, the 10th anniversary to the day of the release of The Dark Knight in theaters. And accordingly, Warner Brothers is re-releasing The Dark Knight theatrically. However, they are only doing it in IMAX in four cities. And what are those four cities? Why, they are Los Angeles, San Francisco, New York, and Toronto, I believe. And
well,
of
Toronto's
course,
not that far from Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Actually, it's very far.
It's
very far, but
across the country of Canada.
You know, relatively speaking.
True, but it's probably closer, I would assume, to Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, where we are now, than it is to Southeast Alabama.
That's true.
So Nick and I will not be able to engage in this film despite our amazing fandom.
Now see, I'm hoping that there will be a demand for it and that it will expand somewhat. And that there might at least be, you know, like an Atlanta or a, dare I say it, Birmingham at it or something like that. That would give us the opportunity. Because if it happens, if it happens any within like a 4-hour driving distance, I am 100% doing it.
Oh, me too. Yeah, and we can make a little road trip out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a lot of fun, actually. But let's see. I hope they do it.
Yep.
But from there, let's transition from some good Batman news to some bad Batman news. Because you may remember, recently, we were talking about the possibility that the Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie would just never happen. Well, as it turns out, it's happening. Official confirmation that this film is scheduled for a 2019 release
1 month before Wonder Woman 1984, the much-anticipated follow-up to Wonder Woman. Joaquin Phoenix has even started doing interviews about this film. Nick, your thoughts?
In the immortal words of one Bad Luck Fale, fuck him!
You gonna buy a Bad Luck Fale fuck him shirt?
I totally want one. Although I understand it's not appropriate to wear in everyday parlance.
Yes. I think my skepticism toward this project is well documented at this point.
It's not, you know, honestly, it's not that I doubt that it could be a well-made movie. I really don't doubt that.
Right.
I doubt the need for it, and I doubt that it will be a well-made Joker movie. Like, it's you can be a good movie and not be a good adaptation of a character. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
I think Batman Begins falls, or not Batman, excuse me, Batman Returns falls into that category a little bit. Even though I love the movie, it's not particularly great as a Batman movie. Something we will touch on and discuss in the coming months, and, you know, not to get off on too much of a tangent, I think Thor Ragnarok is a really good movie that isn't that great of a Thor movie. You know, like, it's, and I think that's going to be, has a very real potential to wind up being the end result here. Now, that being said, there's a legitimate question to be asked. Is it worth it to at least get a good movie from DC, which we haven't had in a while? Probably.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know.
No, I think that's fair.
I'm torn on this
guess
one.
I'm not even sure it's going to be a good movie, though. I mean, it might be. It could be.
I say that based on the talent that's involved. I mean, you've got Martin Scorsese, and you've got Joaquin Phoenix. I mean, that makes sense. I do not know how the Todd Phillips of it all fits into the situation, but we'll see. I'm saying I think there are the pieces on the board. Creative talent involved could make this a decent story to watch, even if it isn't a story that I ever want to see told with a Joker.
Right. I can completely see where you're coming from. I also am skeptical about the project. Another project that I'm skeptical of, but, you know, I can understand some excitement about it as well. The more details, rather, have emerged about the planned Birds of Prey movie from Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
The latest rumor du jour, according to The Wrap and our good friend Umberto Gonzalez, is that Birds of Prey will feature a team roster of Huntress, Black Canary, Renee Montoya, Cassandra Cain, and the previously announced Harley Quinn. And they go into some of the character details, which are all aligned with the comic books here.
Mm-hmm.
Although, interestingly, the movie version of Black Canary, at least according to this synopsis that Umberto Gonzalez released, it would be the traditional comic book version where she is the daughter of the original Black Canary from the Golden Age. So, kind of interesting if they go that route. But, I mean, from a lineup perspective, Nick, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I think the only one that sits weird with me is Cassandra Cain, just because I find it odd that, based on what we understand about this, it would introduce Cassandra Cain to the DC Cinematic Universe, or Extended Universe, whatever the fuck we're going to call it now, before it would introduce Barbara Gordon. And I think those two characters, their histories are so interlinked in terms of Barbara providing an inspiration to Cassandra to become more heroic. So I guess you could have an early version of Cassandra Cain in here, almost as like a young character that the Birds of Prey take under their wing, and it might work in that regard. But that's the only bit of it that kind of makes me go, huh, that's kind of weird. We'll see how it turns out. Most sounds okay. I still don't have faith in the creative process over at DC to turn out a satisfactory product based on the Birds of Prey, however.
Speaking of DC women kicking ass, we're about to see another classic, or modern classic, rather, DC Woman King Ass on the small screen. And that is because a few, you know, you might remember several weeks ago, we announced on the show, on the Rundown, which is how everyone gets their news about comics, right,
mm-hmm.
Nick? Right. On the Rundown.
Yep.
We announced exclusively on our show, of course,
mm-hmm.
that Batwoman would be featured in the CW crossover this fall,
mm-hmm.
Between Arrow, The Flash, and Supergirl. Well, more news has come out of that, in that now we have found out that CW is planning for a possible 2019 debut for a live-action Batwoman television series that is actively in development. It will be written and produced by former Smallville executive producer Carolyn Dries, or Dries, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. It's going to be all about Kate Kane as Batwoman in Gotham, according to this write-up, which is opening up a whole other can of worms in the Arrowverse. Now, we don't know if this is going to take place on Supergirl's Earth or if it's going to take place on the Arrowverse Earth. But regardless, bringing Batwoman into the fold is an exciting step forward, and I'm really curious how they approach this whole thing.
If it happens, if it so happens that Supergirl's Earth is going to remain a separate Earth from the Arrowverse Earth, I want this to happen on Supergirl's Earth. I think that would give it a nice opportunity to expand that world and make it feel like more of a larger shared universe rather than Supergirl being off in a corner by herself. Secondly, while I am beyond excited for this because I think it's something that has the potential to be really damn good, we've heard the CW president talk about how they want to kind of limit the number of comic shows they have right now. Is it not possible that to get Batwoman, we have to lose something else? And is
I think it is possible.
Not possible that most likely would wind up being Legends of Tomorrow?
You know, I hate... If that happens,
is it worth it? I say no.
No. No, it would not be worth it. No, not if we have to lose Legends, no, absolutely not. The other possibility that crossed my mind is Stephen Amell has talked about, you know, he's not going to be able to play Oliver Queen forever. So
it's not worth it to lose Arrow for me.
No, like, it wouldn't be worth it to lose Arrow. I wouldn't want to lose any of the shows.
No, that's the thing. Like, and that's my concern is,
know,
is it
you
wouldn't
know what
just...
I would like to lose? Anything else on the CW.
Yeah. But they're not going to do that for whatever reason, so I don't know. Maybe they'll change their mind. I think they will. You know, commit to a full week of DC programming, you know, a show on every night the way they probably should. But right now I'm just taking his previous comments at face value. Let's hope that mentality has changed.
Absolutely. The beauty of it is, though, you have to wonder if the CW were to remove one of those shows, you'd have to wonder if DC would pick it up on their... since they're looking for original
content. Good point.
So that's a possibility anyway. So, yeah, it's an exciting proposition. I'm looking forward to seeing Kate Kane adapted on the small screen. And I wonder if this will tie in at all to the fact that Oliver mentioned Bruce Wayne last season on Arrow.
Yeah, that's,
or if they will kind of
that's the other thing. You cannot do a Batwoman show without addressing Bruce Wayne and why he's not on the show. Like, this in the same way that Supergirl eventually had to address Superman, you have to address Batman directly if you're going to do a Batwoman show. Have to.
Well, speaking of universes within universes, Mark Miller's Miller World Projects, he's signed a deal with Netflix long ago, and he's making comics for them now, and recently, just this week, in fact, Netflix optioned 5 projects for TV and film development from its recent acquisition of Mark Miller's creator-owned imprint, Miller World. The 5 projects are going to be Jupiter's Legacy, American Jesus, Huck, Empress, and an upcoming comic book, Sharky the Bounty Hunter. Now, obviously, Netflix is in the original content creation business, and business is booming.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much about any of these series except for Huck, which I've read the first volume of, and I honestly wasn't a huge fan of Huck, but I'm glad to see Mark Miller making money off of this, and a lot of these have interesting premises, so I've heard a lot of good things about Jupiter's Legacy in particular, so... What are your thoughts on this thing, Nick?
Yeah, I know nothing about the particulars of these individual series. I don't know what they're about. I don't have the slightest idea of their concepts other than Mark Miller is involved, and I'm generally a fan of his work most of the time. So good for him, and good for Netflix recognizing that comics are a valuable property still, and they're still these creator-owned properties are the place to mine for original content. And so let's hope this just continues to open the door for other creators to cash in on their own properties.
Well, speaking of properties, Jessica Jones is a hot property right now.
Yes.
Created by Brian Michael Bendis. It's red hot on account of Netflix, largely, and their shows. Well, Marvel is trying to capitalize on this and launching a line of digital comics called Marvel Digital Originals. Mm-hmm. And one of the first of these to be announced, maybe the first to be announced, is a new Jessica Jones ongoing by writer Kelly Thompson and artist Mattia DeLulis.
Don't worry about it.
It launched this past Wednesday. And, Nick, I know that this is something that is probably going to be right in your wheelhouse.
It is, but I'm sorry, not to continue the Dark Knight Rises discussion, but I've still got the movie playing in the background. Greg, they only show him very briefly, but do you remember young Ra's al Ghul making an appearance in the movie?
Vaguely.
Yeah, they're doing the flashback sequence where it shows the league coming back to the pit. You know who he looks like? A lot like, actually?
Who's that?
Marty Skrull.
Oh my God, you're right. I've seen this movie so many times, I don't even have to look at it to know what you're talking about. But yeah, he does look like the villain, Marty Skrull.
He really does.
Or Marty Sherrill, as JR says.
To the point where I'm not entirely convinced it isn't him. But anyway, Jessica Jones, obviously, you throw something out there with that character, I am going to be interested. I'm going to wind up picking this at some point. I may actually wait for the physical trade, just because, you know, I'm so far behind on my comics reading, I don't feel a need to rush out and download this digitally just yet. But the fact that Brian Michael Bendis pretty much handpicked Kelly Thompson to take over this – it's Kelly Thompson, right? I have that right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, take over this title gives me some faith that the character will be handled well, and I like the preview art I have seen. So I'm looking forward to reading this whenever I get the opportunity to. And I think it's an interesting approach to highlight specifically the characters who are enjoying higher profiles as a result of television properties right now through this initiative. I think you and I both are in agreement that digital comics are, at the very least, a major part of the comics industry's future. I think you're more gung-ho on the idea than I probably am, but this is a good idea to try and further push people into that landscape. So we'll see how it goes, but I'm excited about reading it eventually.
Indeed. And I've just lost my screen here. Another thing that's happening from Marvel Comics is there's no other transition I can think of for that. They are working with their longtime collaborative partner, IDW, to create new comic books for a new generation of readers. Mm-hmm. IDW and Marvel are partnering for a new comic book line featuring Spider-Man, the Avengers, and Black Panther, mm-hmm. starting this November. Mm-hmm. It says here, right on this thing that I'm reading on my screen here, that the two companies will develop middle-grade comic books designed for younger readers, featuring some of Marvel's most popular characters. The monthly issues and trade paperback collections, published by IDW, will be available for sale at local comic book shops and book retailers across the country. This sounds like an awesome idea, Nick. Monthly release, trade format, you know, aimed at younger readers. I love it.
The only thing about it that isn't already currently happening is the trade format, because all of the animated Marvel shows, whether it be Avengers Assemble or Spider-Man or Guardians of the Galaxy, they all have spin-off comic books that are in shops every month that are aimed at younger readers and done in the art style from the animated series. So I'm a little confused.
But are they available in bookstores, though?
I couldn't tell you that. I mean, I haven't looked at a bookstore selection in a while. So yeah, I guess there's the bookstore element and there's the trade paperback element. But I'm a little confused as to what Marvel's young reader strategy is at this point. You know, are you trying to appeal to them with your own line? Are you trying to appeal to them with IDW's line? What is going to be the distinction between the two? And I'm a little... What is the role of IDW in this? Like, if this is going to be a priority for Marvel, why not do it yourself? Like, why not, you know...
Why have IDW publish it, right?
Right. Why not put the full Marvel promotional push behind it? It almost feels like they are setting themselves up for an easy out to stop doing this down the line right. by saying, well, it was a partnership and it didn't work out, rather than going fully into it. I don't want to be too cynical about this.
They've worked with IDW on these artist versions, and I've always wondered how that works.
Yes.
Because, you know, like, you'll see an IDW Walt Simonson Thor collection. Mm-hmm. It'll be the artist edition or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or you'll see that with Frank Miller's Daredevil.
Right.
Or Bill Sienkiewicz's Elektra, I think, as
and
well.
And I think that's what concerns me, is most of their work with IDW to this point has been very niche product, right? And this Young mm-hmm. Readers Initiative to work, you're going to want it to appeal to as wide a swath of young readers and as casual a readership as you possibly can. And by partnering with IDW, it makes me wonder if it's just a flawed setup from the get-go. Look, the idea behind it is great. Like, I'm like you. I want this Turk. I think it's one of the things that that comic publishers have to do in the future, is more efforts to reach out to younger readers. But I don't know that this approach is necessarily one that has Marvel's full backing.
Fair points. I don't know enough about the project. I will say, I thought it was interesting, they used the term middle grader children.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if that's just, you know, weird PR type, or if that means that they're going for a little bit different audience than the cartoon books, which I think are usually Y7
yeah.
are aiming for.
Yeah, I would, when I hear middle grade, typically that means fourth to sixth grade.
Right. So maybe that's it.
Maybe that is it. That's a good point.
Maybe their thought is that there isn't that bridge
right.
from the kids that are reading the very simple mm-hmm. young kid comics to jump right into regular Marvel comics now, which are, you know, probably not. I haven't been a kid in a long time, sadly, but you know, it might be a bit harsh to jump into a regular mainstream Marvel or DC comic right now without that bridge to lead you there. And it kind of leads to a greater discussion that we can't have tonight about, you know, maybe that's something that's missing in comics, is the concept that maybe they should be for all ages to begin with, you know, in to a degree, you know, maybe not all ages, but you know what I'm saying.
There should be a comic for all ages. Like, you know,
right.
you can have your adult theme comics and you can have mm-hmm. your young focus comics, but there should be a wide swath of comics that both adults and children can enjoy interchangeably. I agree.
And there, just as an anecdote, my boss was at my shoot job, was going through a list of Marvel subscriptions. He was asking me if they still did subscriptions, and I said, I think so. And so he looked it up, and they did. And he was trying to find a comic that his kids could read. So he was like, I would love for them to get into comics. And so he was going through the list, and there wasn't a single comic on that list that Marvel gives out subscriptions that was for kids that was not rated teen or above. And his kids are both very young, like five, you know, six and under. So, yeah, that's an issue we can talk about another time.
Just out of curiosity, were they offering their full publishing lineup for subscription, or just selected titles?
No, just selected titles.
Yeah.
It was a lot. It was more than I thought, because I told him it was probably going to be like 12 books or something. But it was more than that.
Right.
But it wasn't their entire publishing line.
Right.
At least from what it said on that website. So. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to another Marvel announcement. A lot of Marvel this week, because Marvel is bringing back one of my favorite
mm-hmm.
lines of comics that Marvel's ever published,
mm-hmm.
which is What If?
Mm-hmm.
Or, if you prefer, What If?
Yep.
Now, for those of you that don't know, that maybe weren't reading comics in the 80s and 90s...
It's exactly what it sounds like.
Yes, it's taking a spin traditionally on classic comic book stories and saying, what if something else happened instead of that?
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, one that I had when I was a kid was, what if the Hulk had killed Wolverine? And there was classic encounter. There was another. It's just a lot of fun. And I don't know what they've got planned for this new run, but it seems like there's a lot you can do and pull from the last decade of Marvel to run what if scenarios. Like, you know, what if Dark Reign had been good? You know, it's like there's different things you can go, different directions you can go in. You know, what if Iron Man had died at the end of Civil War? You know, like, there's all kinds of cool things you can do with it. So I'm excited about this. Nick, what do you think?
Yeah, it's exciting. These are perfect examples of something I will just read on Marvel Unlimited, because they're one shots. I'm not committing myself to an entire series, and they don't affect continuity, so I have no issue waiting 6 months down the road. Can't wait for these to hit MU. Cool concept. They should probably never not be doing these. Like, I would rather see these than annuals, honestly. Like, why not have these be the answer to DC's Hanna-Barbera and Looney Tunes crossovers they've done recently?
Mm-hmm.
Just do these. Do like, you know, two or three of these every month. You know, solicit crazy ideas from relatively new writers and artists, and just use it as an idea, as a place to experiment and do whatever the hell you want. Just have fun with your characters. I'm all for it.
Absolutely. Real quick, before we move on to our last story, I do want to mention, because we are committed to any time that our passions cross over, mentioning it, Rey Mysterio is getting his own one-shot comic where he explores the history of the Rey Mysterio mask, dating back to his uncle and beyond, perhaps, in this comic. So good for Rey. Hope it does well. And from there, we move on to a little story that I wanted to talk about, because we are getting a crossover that I think everyone's always wanted. A crossover that I have, when we're at the airport every week, people are coming up to me and they're saying, when are you guys going to petition DC to do this crossover? And finally, after a write-in campaign by myself, DC is giving us a Shakespeare Batman 66 crossover. That's right, folks. They're crossing over in a book called No Holds Barred, with Bard spelled B-A-R-D, of course, because Shakespeare was indeed the Bard, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And not only does it have the appeal of the amazing pun of No Holds Barred, it also shares the title of the greatest wrestling movie of all time.
Not just the greatest wrestling movie of all time, but one of the greatest movies in general of all time. So, yeah, I know you're really excited about this. We'll see how it turns out, I guess.
Indeed so. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings an end to the rundown. Now, that can only mean that it's time for a segment where Nick and I find out what each other have been viewing and consuming with our eyes otherwise. It's a segment we call Read and Watching.
Reading and Watching. What have you been reading and watching?
So, Nick, what you been reading and watching?
Not watching much of anything, because all our stories are off right now. So, did do a little bit of reading. Finally, my massive stack of comics in there in the throne room so that I could, you know, use that time wisely. And so I actually read 5 issues of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps. I read 44 through 48, the first 5 parts of the Dark Star Rising story that is going to culminate. You know, it's going to wrap up Robert Venditti's entire run on this title to this point. And I have to say, got to see how they stick the landing. But to this point, I don't say too much because I think this is actually one of the rare titles I'm reading that you might actually catch up on, and I don't want to spoil anything for you. I think it's the best Green Lantern story that's been told since Geoff Johns left. I think it's that good.
Wow.
It's that compelling. It takes a character in Tomar 2, puts a new spin on him, redefines him, and makes him what could wind up being one of the most compelling Green Lantern villains of them all if they don't walk it back, and I really, really, really hope they don't. I've loved everything about this story this far.
Man, you've really set a high bar for that. I'm looking forward to that. And that is one that I have every issue of to this point, as far as I know. And I do plan on catching up. Now that my pull list has been stricken down for the most part, I'll have time, theoretically, to start making my way through my backlog. And that's one of the first books that I want to catch up on, because I'm going to carry that through to fruition. But man, that's really high praise, and I'm interested to find out how they've managed to take a Tomar 2 in such a direction. Very good. Anything else?
No, that was it.
Okay, well, I haven't been reading anything this past week, except lots of boring documents at work.
Oh, wait, one thing. I did watch something.
Oh, what'd you watch?
I watched the first episode of season 2 of Jessica Jones.
Ah,
and I freaking loved it. Predictably, I don't think there's any way that this will ever surpass season one in the end for me, because I think season one of Jessica Jones, I've said this many times, I think it's not just the best Marvel Netflix thing that Marvel has done. I think it's one of the best adaptations of any sort that Marvel has done, whether that be movie or television or what have you.
Mm.
But one episode in, I'm hooked. It's a slower paced story. They are definitely, you know, stretching the taffy, but the characters are so damned interesting, and you care about them to a degree that you don't mind on this first episode. It maintains the storytelling sensibilities. It has a certain quirkiness about it that the first season had in terms of Jessica and her interaction with these people. I'm hooked, and I can't wait to see more.
Did you just use the term stretching the taffy?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever heard that utilized.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate it, Nick. I appreciate any time someone can take what appears to be an early 20th century colloquialism and bring it back on our show.
I do what I can.
I'm a big fan.
I do what I can.
Big fan. I also have been watching something. I have watched another episode or two. I watched two more episodes of the excellent sci-fi series Krypton, or Krypton, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, Nick, the more I watch this show, the more I start to think that if it had been included in the CW, that it might have been my favorite of this season. Because I got to say, man, it is blowing me away right now.
Wow. I have every intention of catching up at some point, so don't get too heavy into the spoilers.
I'm not going to spoil a damn thing. Right. Too many twists and turns along the way. I will say it goes in a lot of surprising directions, and things are not what they appear to be pretty much from Jump Street on this. So
where is it? How are you watching it right now?
I'm watching it on demand on my DirecTV Now.
Okay, so it's on demand. Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All right, cool.
So, with that being said, I got nothing else on reading and watching.
That's it, man.
Now, what I'm going to pose for the next few weeks, Nick,
mm-hmm.
instead of our usual wrestling minute,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to propose that we take just a smidge more time,
mm-hmm.
do a little bit of a G1 analysis, because both of us are watching the New Japan Pro Wrestling G1 Climax,
mm-hmm.
which sounds like something that would be a lot of physical fun for one, but it's mm-hmm. actually just the name of a wrestling tournament.
Yes, it is. You know, a G1 Climax, given my love of the Georgia Bulldogs and the Power G, sounds like something I would have many times throughout the fall. But this is actually a wrestling-related thing.
Yes. And thanks to Nick's kindness, I've been able to also observe the G1 Climax to this mm-hmm. point for the first time ever in my life, keep mm-hmm. up with it as it's going on New Japan World. What are your thoughts so far? I know you haven't watched night three yet. I have one match left to watch on night three, but we both watched the first two nights.
Yeah, I've obviously loved it thus far. I know there are New Japan purists who will, you know, shout about how it's not as good as it used to be a few years ago or what have you, or the field isn't interesting or whatever. But as someone who is watching for the first time,
mm-hmm.
it continues to showcase what New Japan does better than anybody else, and that's when wrestlers face off in singles matches, there are stakes and it means something. Outcomes matter in New Japan, unlike they do anywhere else on the face of the planet. And no greater example of that than the G1. Every match has felt like it has big stakes, and I have enjoyed virtually every match, at least to a certain degree, that I've seen thus far. Every singles match, anyway. And I thought that both Kenny Omega and Tetsuya Naito, as well as Kota Ibushi and Zack Sabre Jr., had all-time classic performances on night two of the G1, and I can't wait to see more of that B-block. A-block has been good, but there's no doubt that B-block is going to be the showcase block of the tournament.
Absolutely. Both those matches were outstanding. Omega and Naito was an instant classic. But I also want to give a shout-out to Hirooki Goto and Sanada,
mm-hmm.
who had a match that I wasn't really anticipating at all. You know, I like Sanada, and I like Goto okay, but I'm not really a huge fan of either of theirs.
And they really went out and tore the house down and set the tone for what Ibushi and Sabre would do. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Naito and Omega. Really fan of that match between those two. I really enjoyed Suzuki and Tanahashi on the first night. Really enjoyed a match that I just watched a minute ago, actually. Kazuchika Okada versus Bad Luck Fale. Very simple match, very simple story, but they told it very well. And I'm continuing to enjoy, Nick, I think what surprised both of us is the integration of storylines and angles into these matches so far, both with the Bullet Club split and with the Chaos split with Switchblade Jay White.
Mm-hmm. And also the continued story of Kazuchika Okada's loss of confidence in the wake of his Dominion loss to Kenny Omega.
Yes, yes. How he's almost wrestling in a totally new manner where he's more free-spirited, but it's not paying off for him.
Right.
And he's just spiraling downward. So that's been great. The only other thing I have to add on wrestling this week is that, Nick, I've never had an earring put in before.
Mm-mm.
And probably never will.
Mm-mm.
But if I do, I would ask that you please do not stick your finger in it and drag me around.
Yes, and I would say that if I did, Greg, it wouldn't be that cool if I did it. And it probably wouldn't be that painful, and it would probably be a lame way to beat somebody down.
Absolutely. And if you didn't explain exactly why you were doing it at the time you were doing it,
mm-hmm.
it would render the entire thing moot. So
absolutely. Well, I'm glad we're in agreement on that.
So that being said, folks, you can find us on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87.
Indeed.
You can shoot us an email, gregp@placetobenation.com. NickD@placetobenation.com, or you can join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page. We have a lot of activity there. Everyone is welcome. We're a community. We love talking comics, trading viewpoints, having conversations, having fun, most importantly. That's a good way for any of you to communicate with us. And Dark Knight Month is not over,
nope.
by the way,
nope.
for the Hard Travel Families. We have one more episode next week. We are going to be counting down our favorite scenes in the Dark Knight trilogy, our five favorite scenes in the trilogy. Going to be a tough one, folks, as you can tell. We love these movies.
We really do. As I said last week, it's going to be really tempting to have nothing but scenes from the Dark Knight, but I just don't know. It's gonna be interesting. I can't wait to see how it turns out and how much similarity there is between the lists.
Yes, and then after we get through that and Dark Knight Month comes to an end, we'll be right back to our normal schedule,
mm-hmm.
where we'll be hitting up Hard Travelers for Hire,
mm-hmm.
with a look at Spider-Man Homecoming, which is I think going to be a little bit interesting. I'll just say I'm going to end up being very outnumbered on that podcast. and so that'll happen. And then you have what else do we have coming that way? I don't know. I'm not looking at the schedule right now.
That suffices for now. That's 2 weeks out. Yeah. That's you know, we can't expect these people to retain this knowledge for that long.
You
got the next 2 weeks of shows. What more do you want from us?
Right. The one thing you have to have faith in is that you are indeed listening to the
longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all of Place to Be Nation. And
with the Big E hip swivel, as we said that, by the way.
Absolutely. Always the Big E hip swivel.
Mm-hmm.
And we are nothing if not consistent. It's not like we'd ever miss a release of our podcast. Never. That's mm-hmm. not us. We like the release. We like the G1 climax of it all. So hope you come back next week and join us as we G1 climax all about the Dark Knight trilogy to conclude Dark Knight Month. So long, folks!
Cup.